So we've had some sentiment that measuring provider education, at least in the dental world, might not be a good thing to do because it doesn't. There's no evidence that it actually produces any improvement in health. What about referral? Is that, I mean, I'm hearing different things about referral. The data's terrible, but it still might be important to track whether it was done. Is that the sentiment of the group that, that probably we should still call for measures about referral, or is that also in, fall in the category of education? Why bother? You do more important things.
Well, I think you get to the heart of the issue of how does it get documented in order for us to measure it, and that's probably not the scope of this this group. I know that the way we document referrals is in data points so that you can actually measure them all in drop-down boxes that were all first validated, and that was a long process that gave my hairdresser lots of work to do on my gray hairs. And now we have great data that we share among different organizations in a great data repository. So, you know, I think it's possible, but if you don't do it that like that, then you have 0.00 results. So I think referrals is where it needs to go. I think that is really, really important information. But it's like with carriers, how do you calibrate all the providers and all the people who refer?
But if you're saying it's important, then there still could be a call for people to develop measures, and maybe they'll come up with them or not.
So. I would say so. Yeah, there's hope.
Yeah. Michael?
I was just going to comment. I know in Minnesota there's something called Minnesota Community Measurement. They've looked at care for diabetics, for example. And I know a big part of that is you've got standard recommendations regarding referrals for eye exams, dental, different pieces, and tracking, you know, not only whether the referral was made, but whether the person actually followed up. So I agree. I mean, my sense is that, you know, if we want to integrate over time the practice of medicine with dentistry, that we've got to start setting up and tracking, you know, especially for diabetics. Maybe we could agree, you know, hey, let's, for diabetics, you know, it's pretty obvious this, we ought to be doing this. Maybe there's a couple other categories that we want to, pregnant women. But anyway, I think it's important.
All right, so then we would say, basically we're talking about the same kind of thing. We're talking about calling for people to develop measures of referrals. What does it actually mean when you say there was a referral or not? Mm-hmm. And then you might want to stratify whatever data you get by the various kind of examples like you just gave.
One thought, so maybe here we might want to think looking at the meaningful use measures, because there are measures around referral and how that's being measured. I know that we are going with the meaningful use measures, implementing those. So that might be, you know, one area to look at.
So that might be a data source for people already doing meaningful use work then. So there's next one kind of in the middle of the page. I think we've already addressed, unless people have things to say more about it, which is provider availability and contribution, which has to do with, it just was many different kinds of measures about whether there's availability in the safety net or adequacy of the network or who are the dentists that are available or where are they or retention rates among dentists. Those, I think, all sort of come under the category of availability of providers. And any discussion about that, calling for measures to track availability of providers?
No, Mary Alice touched on that a little bit before, I know.
Okay. It's
36.
Line 36, yeah.
On page 3.
Got it. So if not, the next grouping has to do with kind of loosely the use of various kinds of services, specific services. So it was actually more detailed in the long version. There was everything from endodontic services and ratios of, you know, endodontic treatment to extractions and crowns versus fillings and all kinds of use of service measures. And actually, just in an anomaly of the organization here, the preventive services are broken out in a different section. So this kind of grouping doesn't include them because they come up really next in the next page. But I guess the call, if we agree that this is important, would be to call for people to develop various measures of services received by people. Thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I think
in general, people think that it's useful, but, you know, grossly inadequate. I mean, it's just the beginning.
Yeah.
But it is useful as a means of comparison for looking at, you know, individuals covered by certain types of program, Medicaid versus a CHIP program versus commercial plan versus uninsured, if you can get that kind of information. Within those categories, again, you can look at specific contractors who are responsible and see variation. You can see regional differences. You could see differences by age, et cetera. So, I mean, it's just a very coarse and crude way of starting to look at whether or not at utilization of services.
Okay.
And, you know, then let the debates begin as to whether it's because of providers or whether it's because of people who don't seek care and whatever. But you measure and then you go from there.
Okay. You're voting for leaving it in. Is it?
Yeah. Andrew?
Any other thoughts, Andy?
So when I worked for the Wisconsin Medicaid program, one of the things I always wanted but could never get was completion of treatment plan. And I think that would be something that really is worth emphasizing so that it's not just, okay, I saw Johnny. Johnny had a claim for a two-surface filling in a front tooth. Is Johnny set now? You know, do I know enough about, you know, whether he's gotten to a place where maybe you can do disease management and getting to a lower risk status? And so if there were some better way to track that off claims, that would be extremely helpful to public insurance management.
So let me just ask a question about that to the group, which is you're suggesting that is important. The question I want to ask is it feasible based on do people know what completion of treatment plan means? So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some dentists will tell you a treatment plan is never complete. I mean, you know, they sort of, I'm telling you, okay? So, but we've recently sort of, you know, toyed with this through some of the work we're doing through the Dental Quality Alliance as well, and Krishna can remind me what we've come up with. And I guess it's treatment that's planned but not completed.
Towards the end, we decided we couldn't really define the word completion.
Right. Right. So, but again, inherited, I mean, exactly to Andy's point, an individual enters a care system, they get an examination, along with that, they get a plan for at least an episode of care. That's what we've sort of moved the language and the frame to defining episodes of care. And, you know, so in an ideal world, in a pediatric dentist mindset, it's, you know, you come in, you get the examination, you get your list of things that need to be done, you work through the restorative and all that, and then you go into a maintenance phase of care and et cetera. But there a way to mark those, and, you know, so I think that's the important piece, which is very much a stride to what you see in terms of measurement in other aspects of care, episodes of care.
David?
Not intended to be kind of a quip, but the measurement of a completion of a treatment plan is one thing, but in many cases, these populations that we're talking about, it's the measurement of the creation of a treatment plan. So many just seek care for episodal acute need, and we're challenged to even get them to a point where they have a comprehensive examination and the creation of a treatment plan. So, again, just couldn't help but make that comment.
Dick?
I couldn't agree with you more. Every time I hear the... no, I'm just going to back you up a little bit more. You know, every time I hear the discussion about quality of care, I kind of get the shakes because it has so many different definitions. But there are ways, using the data that's available, not to measure the technical quality of care, but the quality of the decision-making process of the dentist, both in terms of the services that are planned in the treatment plan and the execution of that plan. And Dave, you're actually right. That's definitely the case, especially with large populations. Jim?
Yeah, and just, you know, so as a point, I mean, one of the measures that the DQA is looking at and including in a starter set is that does a patient receive a comprehensive examination or a periodic examination? And, you know, that looks like a narrow little slice of what you're trying to look at. But as a marker in a process of care, I think it's an important marker. So I think that, you know, in these utilization of services measures, no one of them is going to tell you anything, but you can start to construct profiles and sort of, as you said, you know, assessments of proxies of what's going on in care by having some of these markers. And the issue about defining when an episode of treatment has been completed, whatever, however you use it, that end marker, is a long-standing void in the data capture system.
So what I'm... Oh, go ahead, Bobby.
I can see that for the federally qualified health centers, there is an effort afoot, and CineQuest is also working with us to develop a treatment completion monitoring tool as an indicator of quality. Now, it's very important when you consider the FQHCs because they're paid... unlike general practice and fee for service, they're on a cost-based reimbursement type of system that actually rewards visits rather than procedures done per visit. So for that reason, it's important for them because we want to make sure that within a given time, in this case, like years, what we're looking at, that a proportion of those treatments are completed because it would be easy to milk that patient by having them come back per surface and just simply put a filling in and just stretch out each of the encounters in order to generate more revenue. So this is a way to say that the churning effect isn't happening because we can document to some extent the treatment that was planned, or as you say, the episode of treatment was completed within a calendar year. So there are, I mention this because there are efforts afoot to do this. Now, granted, it hasn't been a part of the past, not at least to the degree that would be useful, but it is becoming a part of the trend. So in one sense, it would not hurt us to be at least aware of that trend and actually maybe capture that, that this activity is occurring. It will be data down the road. We should be ready for to capture that data.
And you're talking about that's based on what I call phases of care, like phase one completion is the...
Right.
Is
well, the, I mean, yeah. For the sake of this audience, I would say it doesn't have to necessarily be phase one.
Right.
It can actually be whatever the episode that...
Right.
Electronic
so
health records, for example, you load the system with what you're going to do over a period of time, and then you measure the cutoff point. I completed that entire system of episodes. And then there's a benchmark. You can put a dummy code. There's a number of ways of doing it where you can flag that is now in a maintenance state.
So what I'm getting here out of the, this is a huge effort in reductionism here, but out of was probably 100 measures in the big pile that had to do with services received. And, again, we're cutting out preventive services. Does come up in the next category, but forgetting preventive for a moment, which is measures that we're calling for measures of oral health examination or assessment, comprehensive dental examination, creation of treatment plan, completion of treatment plan based on episodes or phases of care, whether any service was received, and then a whole list of specific treatment services that might have been received. Do we miss anything in that? In that reductionist exercise? Okay. Good. Well, then we're into the last couple in this section are have to do with the use of the emergency room and the use of the operating room. And maybe sedation needs to be in there a little more explicitly than it is.
I just was thinking with respect to use of the emergency department, why limit it to just a count of after-hours visits?
Sure. Yeah, that was just one.
Oh, no, I think that's in addition to an emergency department, an after-hours setting. Not after-hours in the emergency department, but an urgent care center or something like that. So that's a separate location from an emergency department.
There's a slash between those two,
yeah.
So they're two concepts. Just in, scrolled into one, scrunched into one sentence, but it's two concepts.
Jim?
Paul, in this context, and I had a little bit of discussion with folks at the American Academy of Pediatrics who are actually working on a project for ARC to look to try to see if there's some way to enhance the current treatment measure, which is not this per se. But I think this one of the ideas that came up, which I think is an interesting one, is not just looking isolated to see, you know, how many individuals present in an emergency room for some dentally related condition, but looking to see, you know, even beyond that, then do they get hooked up with a dental provider to address what's the fundamental problem that got them to the emergency room in the first place. So, I mean, again, it's part of this sort of looking at sort of the pathways of care or patterns of care that are important, looking at, you know, not just did they show up. I mean, I think that's important in itself to get an extent, an indicator of, you know, whether your upstream system is working, but to look, you know, at sort of where was there any care, you know, in the dental arena, you know, at any period prior to that, and was it episodic or was it something that was, you know, something that's a little bit more continuous? And then following the emergency visit, is there a system in place, care coordination or whatever, that gets that person to somewhere where they can get the problem definitively treated?
Yeah, it touches on the referral as well. Andrew?
Okay. I just want to make sure one key stratification that I don't want to lose out of the emergency room data is between ambulatory care sensitive, I think is what the California Healthcare Foundation study called it, which I think is a good term. So preventable conditions that are dentally related and those that aren't, sort of fights, falls, and accidents. Right. And then related to the OR indicator, which we may not be ready to move to yet, one of the sort of things that I thought was interesting, I think Bert Edelstein's worked on in past years, is repeat trips to the OR for sedation dentistry, which I think is something worth keeping track of, which may be a little separate than just straight visits to the OR.
Dan?
When you said that ambulatory care, would that capture the, and again, because I deal in pediatrics, the kids that show up in a medical provider with a fever, who during the exam, when the provider sees that, in fact, the fever is related to the fact that the child doesn't have the swelling, but in fact has an abscess, and is seen in the medical setting for the dental emergency, they then put them on antibiotics and make the referral to the dental. Will it capture that? Because
if we make that point and indicate that it should, so, I mean, to me, that, you know, I would want to know the difference, or at least the stratification by whether or not they're seen in sort of a typical primary care outpatient setting vis-a-vis an emergency room.
Right, because one of the things we're promoting is the fact that the utilization of urgent care in pediatrics versus, again, the more costly higher level, which is going to the emergency room. So that'll also be impacted whether or not there's availability of an access. Because if the only thing you have is an emergency room, then you're going to use it versus having access to an urgent care.
Okay. So we've talked about some things related to emergency room use. It seems that everybody agrees that's important, and we got some various parameters that could be added to that. And is after-hours services any different, or would the same kind of parameters about subsequent referrals and all that kind of stuff would apply to after-hours care as well? Mike, did you want to?
I just had an added concept, too, that some emergency department visits result in just, you know, antibiotics and narcotics and so on. And I know in one study that was done a few years ago in Minnesota, 40% of those people were repeat visitors. So they were doing that at least twice in a calendar year, 40%. Most were adults, not children. But the most costly scenario are the ones that get admitted. So I'm wondering if we could track, you know, people that go in and they're at such a state that they need to be admitted to the hospital as a result of their untreated dental problems.
Okay, so subsequent admissions would be another.
Yeah, I think we should capture admissions.
You could argue that any disease process like dental caries that results in an OR is essentially an ambulatory sensitive admission.
You just made a quick comment about after hours. I think we want to be very careful how we define that, because there's many clinics who are open, you know, until 8, which would not be considered after hours because that's their regular hours. So it needs to be after closing hours.
With respect to OR, I want to make sure we don't miss this repeated OR issue. And I also think we need to track, we need to make some statement about what's done in the OR. I worked on a Medicaid project over the past year, and because of some rules that were put in Colorado for Medicaid, that restricted what you could do outside of the OR, lots more things happened in the OR, and repeated hospitalizations, repeated OR visits happened, which were, you know, it's not good to keep, you know, keep putting a kid under general anesthesia for relatively minor stuff. So I think sometimes we need to track what's going on with Medicaid plans and health plans, because it can have perverse incentives that lead to things that aren't good for kids.
Well, and then the other thing in regards to what Michael was saying was that if a patient shows up in the emergency room and gets admitted, that's a medical admission. Even though the CPT codes may say dental abscess, it's usually admitted by a physician. So that's on the insurance. Whereas if they showed up in the dental office and had it treated appropriately and they didn't have dental coverage, that's not on the insurance. So you're incentivizing adult population to go use the emergency room because it's covered by their insurance. We see it all the time in general ENT.
So would you say that medical admissions for dental problems is a separate area of measurement?
Well, I just think that you might want to stratify admission status, whether or not they truly get admitted. And then the other thing you might want to stratify is insured versus uninsured, because that might show.
Right. But I was also trying to differentiate, may or may not follow an emergency room visit. They could have a medical admission that they came from somewhere else. So.
Right.
Just kind of related to that, in an urgent care setup, ambulatory setup, I mean, in a study that I was conducting last year, there were a lot of evidence from our urgent care physicians telling that they would see patients repeatedly coming in and kind of talking about pain and asking for narcotics. So there is also real need versus kind of drug abusing scenario that comes in. Maybe we want to capture or provide or ask the people who develop some of the measures to kind of distinguish between that. I mean, I don't know how we would do it, but you know, that's an area which a lot of the physicians kind of, you know, point out, and medical providers, which is a big concern.
Jim?
I think I'm probably at the risk of sort of restating, but I mean, the whole business about repeat operating room episodes, et cetera. I mean, I think I'd broaden that a bit. Again, all the things I said about, you know, people seen in the emergency room, that, you know, the question is, yeah, fine, you know, they've gone in and gotten a mouthful of fillings and crowns and things of that nature, but the real thing that ought to be measured is then, are they identified as high risk? Do they get channeled into regular, you know, basic care and preventive services, and then what's the downstream sort of consequences is that? So it's that same concept about if they just because they show up in an emergency room. I mean, the same thing applies within the dental world, that if a kid gets to the operating room, I mean, way too often, I mean, the literature is pretty replete. They don't show up for follow-up visits. You know, there's no sort of special program put in place other than, you know, the same message, come back in 6 months for your checkup kind of thing, you know. So, I mean, that really, I think, does need to be a part of medicine, or, I mean, the measurement to really start to look at sort of that process of care around that issue.
So that applies to both emergency room and operating room. Right. And so I also wonder, to come back earlier, we talked about patient safety, and maybe it comes in here. We're talking about sedation. Now we're moving in sedation anesthesia. We want to call for some measures based on outcomes or adverse outcomes or based on complications of sedation and anesthesia. I mean, there's complications for anything you do potentially, but these seem like in a different category. So I wonder how the group feels about that.
Yes, Paul, I just want to pick up, too, that more and more, I know as a community setting, we do general sedation in our clinic. And so you might not capture that because we're trying to keep the kids out of the hospital because of a negative impact in terms of an association of going to the hospital plus the cost containment. So we do general anesthesia in our community setting, as do a lot of the private dentists in the area,
right,
particularly for the Medi-Cal kids because they get a decent reimbursement for the service. So
you mean sedation, not general anesthesia?
Anesthesia, yes.
General anesthesia.
Yeah, you have an anesthesiologist come to the office.
Yeah, yeah. If you use a medical anesthesiologist, you get a very high reimbursement. If you use a dental anesthesiologist, then it's a lower reimbursement. But it's a much easier access to be able to do that because of the fact that the hoops and jumps that have to go into doing either a pre-hospitalization H&P and also the pre-authorization. So, yes, we do general anesthesia. Plus, plus oral sedation and nitrous. Those are other levels.
And then,
and I think, you know, I think it's important to be trying to capture that, but B, the measurement issues around it are the data sources. You know, I mean, if that adverse event happens in a hospital setting or whatever, it's going to get reported more than likely, you know, because there's an adverse, you know, an incident reporting system in place. But that doesn't really sort of exist, I don't think, in the general population. And then, you know, you get into malpractice and then everything gets locked up and sealed. And so, I mean, that's why there's, I think, tremendous underreporting about the extent to which this is happening. But
we're seeing a lot more GA and IV sedation than we did before, especially in California. And it looks like, just on the face of it, that it's being overutilized. And I think that there has to be a analysis of the risk associated with doing that versus not. And it seems that a lot of dentists are starting to do this just for their own ease of treating the patient, as opposed to a child really needs it or something of that nature. So that's of concern to us because there can be, obviously, there can be untoward health outcomes associated with this, but the dentists, as I say, especially out west, do not seem to recognize that or don't want to.
So I think we've identified that this area is something that potentially important but potentially hard to get data. So.
But again, from a concept and development standpoint, I think yeah.
Right. I think we're kind of over our time, so we probably should.
So, again, I think hard to get data, maybe not if the dentist have electronic health records. I think if the dentists are on paper, it is much, much harder. If they are not on paper, then it might be easier to get data.
So I think we're running a little bit over our time. And the last area within this group, actually, I think we've already talked about, which is the annual dental utilization. You know, the one sort of measure everyone has is number is visits per year. So I think we've already talked about that. So any other missing concepts in this area that we've been talking about?
There's one we really didn't discuss, and, you know, we've, again, sort of tossed it around a little bit at the DQA level, which is, you know, the some sort of measures of continuity of care, dental home. I think that's an area that, you know, there's a lot of work going on the medical side now. About
usual source of care is
yeah,
often used
and,
in the medical
and
literature.
Patient-centered medical homes, and, you know, there's quite a bit of work being done in that area. And, again, it's all sort of, it's a general sort of, you know, looking at sort of patterns of care or whatever. But I think,
yeah,
you know, way beyond just did somebody get a service in a year, looking at sort of that profile of what kind of care they're getting.
We've done a number of studies on large population bases where we've looked at frequent attenders versus non-frequent attenders. And there's no doubt that over a period, a prospective study over a period of, say, 6 to 7 years, those that are frequent attenders have much better oral health based upon surrogate measurements than those who are not frequent attenders. But we've also found out that the cost at the end of 6 or 7 years between the frequent and non-frequent is the same.
Anything else that's missing, any big concepts missing other than prevention, which we'll get at next, from this idea of care? Everybody ready for...
All right, so before we break for lunch, I just want to make sure, is there anybody on the phone that wants to make any comments, add to the conversation? Please do. No? So any of our visitors with us that want to make a comment at all to the group? No? Okay, great. I think we're going to take a half-hour break for lunch, so a little longer than we had planned because you're doing so well. That's your reward. And we're not going to work through lunch, so just talk to each other, enjoy yourself, do whatever you need to do. We will come back, though. I'm going to be very stickly on this. 10 after 1, we're going to start up again. Thanks, everyone. Hi, everyone. Reminder to myself and others to use your microphones.
don't talk with your mouth full like me. All right, so we're going to get back into the swing of things. I think we're on priority area D, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll get started there. So, again, thank you all for your attention. I know sometimes it's hard to get motivated after lunch. We'll try to keep you awake and away from the food coma. Paul.
I think it was something you said. You might have mentioned the word dessert because half the table got up and walked away.
Yeah. They're getting the coffee so they can last the afternoon.
Paul, I can vouch for the dessert.
Okay. Thank you. Well, so this next area is about oral health promotion, disease prevention, although many of the items under here really relate to the stuff we were just previously talking about. They just pulled them out of the way they were originally listed on the spreadsheet, so forgive the sort of non-logic in terms of the way this all rolls out. But there's just a number of – really, they're just more utilization of services, only these are services for the most part related to preventive services. So there are things like sealants, fluoride varnishes, oral health education, which we've talked about, prophylaxis. Those are the sort of the major prevention procedures that are listed here. And so let me just ask the group about, I think, again, we're going to call for people to develop measures around these concepts. Are there some specific things we want to say about them, some things that are missing in terms of the preventive services? We'll get back to in a few minutes the intraoral films taken and restorations. I think those belong in the previous discussion. So for the moment, let's focus on the preventive things that are here. So other than calling for people to develop measures around these preventive concepts, any other thoughts about them?
From a non-dentist, can you tell me why it would make sense to count numbers of sealants applied as opposed to children who receive sealants?
I can say something about it. Jim, you want to?
Well, I was just going to say I was going to sort of leave all of that, but maybe it shouldn't be assuming as to when it says definitions and various parameters. I figured that a lot of those stripes were going to get tossed in, yeah. You know, whether or not simple counts or percentages or numbers around particular teeth or whatever. I assumed all that was sort of going to fall in there. So, yeah, I mean, I agree from my standpoint, just counting numbers of things that were done without having anything to relate it to me was, you know, not the most meaningful of measures.
I mean, I think these are people have done this in various ways. We saw in the big pile of stuff that there's a lot of different measures of sealants. Some people are measuring children who have sealants, you know, at the child level. Some people are measuring it at the tooth level, how many teeth had sealants, how many tooth per child, certain various age groups. So I guess what we'd be calling for in terms of a high-level concept is what do you mean by when you're measuring a sealant? What's the thing you're measuring and how do you measure it? And then leave it up to people to use that to stratify it by various child teeth, age groups, ethnicity, all the other ways you could stratify the results of that.
One thing I just wanted to mention about sealants is that Delta Dental of Michigan and Delta Dental of Minnesota have done a number of studies on sealants, and we've used a number of different methodologies, and we've done prospective studies that have probably gone on for 8-10 years. And we've looked at individual teeth and split mouth models and number of children and so on and so forth. And we look at sealants versus non-sealants in the population. And what we found out in the end, in terms of numbers of restorations in sealants versus non-sealant individuals or teeth, is that it ends up that there's no difference. And the reason there's no difference is not because sealants don't work from a research and clinical standpoint, but it gets back, and I hate to bring this up, what's happening is dentists and public health clinics are not doing risk assessment. So they're sealing a lot of teeth that do not need to be sealed. So the return on investment is very poor. I got up and discussed this about 2 years at the National Oral Health Conference, and I was tarred and feathered and carried away. But you have to be very careful what you're measuring.
I'm surprised you brought it up again actually after the roasting.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
You know, the Fed said, well, you know, we have all the studies and we know exactly what's going on. But, you know, what could I say to them? I mean, we're looking at millions of people, and they're probably looking at, I don't know how many, but not very many. So sealants are really a problem because there's not risk assessment. And that happens both in private practice offices and in public health settings.
Well, so, again, you're playing David and suggesting that we add risk assessment to this preventive category that, as something that people should develop measures of risk
every assessment. One of them needs risk assessment. Okay.
A different comment not related to that. What I don't see in this is the ART. I'm not sure if it should be in there. And the other thing that I don't see in there at all is anything about nutrition, nutritional counseling, nutritional habits. It's just a different focus on prevention.
Okay, those are good, Dan.
You have a puzzled look on your face, Andrew. Were you about to say something?
I do. Just maybe it will help to get the group sense on this, but there's not a whole lot of evidence to support the prophylaxis does much of anything, right?
I was about to say that.
Yeah, so maybe we should de-emphasize that.
Actually, what I was going to ask is, do you want to, because I think one of the things that we're maybe not doing as much as we've been asked to do is, as we're talking about these various things, to say which are the really important ones and which are the not-so-important ones. And I know within this area, you talk about sealants, fluoride varnishes, other kinds of fluoride treatments, prophylaxis, there's probably a degree of which we think are evidence-based. And so do you want to try and stratify for NQF and HHS? What are the important ones there?
I mean, I would say, you know, in Andy's comment, certainly when you're talking about children, you know, both in terms of fluoride uptake and caries, you know, that prophylaxis piece. But, you know, I mean, so I think the emphasis needs to be much more on the fluoride in that case than, in fact, any measure that looked at just prophylaxis, I wouldn't invest a whole lot of time in. But adults, could be a totally different sort of situation in terms of, you know, early periodontal disease and things of that nature. I'm just speaking particularly to the kids.
I certainly agree with Jim. And as with sealants, both Delta Dental of Michigan under Steve Eklund and we have done a number of studies looking at fluoride applications, prospective studies probably about 8 or 9 years. And we found that after a period of 8 or 9 years, and you look at children who get fluoride and those who don't, that there's no difference in restorations over time. And you know why. I won't even tell you why.
To that point, it's interesting, and I'll get you to that. At the recent evidence-based dentistry conference, where I am one of the moderators, I was talking about a program that I'm involved with, the First Steps program, where we train physicians on placing fluoride varnish in the 0-3 population and all the grand successes that we're having with that, because it falls into the accepted evidence-based guidelines that are out there and all the grand successes that we're having. And whereupon I was taken to task by one of the presenters, many of you know Philippe Pujol, who went off on the fact that he doesn't believe that the evolving evidence shows that 0-3 fluoride is something that is taken up in the children's teeth and has any effect whatsoever. I think when we take a look at measurement, besides the fact that I left that conversation quite deflated on all my wonderful things that I've been doing in the world, when we take a look at measurement, I think we have to take a look at least what is considered to be accepted evidence-based guidelines that are out there. Agreed. There's a lot of questions that you can have on your claims analysis about the efficacy of sealants. And, you know, it's the Wizard of Oz. You know, it's the man behind the curtain. I get it. But we have the evidence-based guidelines, and if we're taking a look at measurement, and this is the best we have to hang our hat on today, then that's our measurement. As evidence evolves, these measures are maintained, and they will evolve.
And, you know, the same themes are just going around. It's the risk assessment and risk-based approach to that that is the sort of the key to it. So I think in terms of measures development going forward, those two things go sort of hand in hand. I mean, when you're really looking at where do you want to concentrate your resources and get out of a one-size-fits-all approach, I mean, that's basically where they come together.
And I think there's another issue, too, and that's research and publications that have been done in sealants and published in JADA and other dental peer-reviewed journals, and the real-world experience. There's definite differences between those, and we would expect that to occur. A controlled environment where sealants or fluorides are used is going to perhaps, and we found, lead to a different conclusion than real-world experience.
So I think the question in that, though, is it something that we want to recommend that there be measured development in this area? I'm getting the sense that the answer is yes, even though in certain circumstances, obviously putting a sealant on someone who doesn't need one is not going to reduce their caries level later on. Still, it seems like we ought to be calling for measured development in these areas. And what I'm hearing is that probably the most important of the things in the preventive list is sealants and fluoride varnish, which have the highest level of evidence, followed by fluoride treatments, and prophylaxis being the least important for kids, maybe have some importance for adults. Does that seem to and all of that being based on risk assessment and risk-based procedures. Does that seem to capture what we've been saying? Okay, so the rest of this little grouping here has some things we've already talked about. Restorations, we've already talked about list of procedures previously. The intraoral OPG films taken, I don't remember what OPG stands for. You may know what that is. No, nobody knows. That's all right. We won't worry about it. that's right. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah. Putting that in the list of procedures we've talked about previously. And the only other thing I think here that's not been talked about is actually recording of assessment of risk is here. The only thing we haven't talked about is this one I think came from the nursing home group, Mike, which is on the daily care needs, daily care needs assessed. And that's, I think, tied to the daily mouth care of. So do you think that needs to be called out separately from risk assessment and risk-based procedures, or is that sort of subsumed within that?
I'm not really sure. It is something that nurses
It is something that nurses are expected to do as part of their standard of care around oral health and oral infection control is to make this assessment. It's part of that one of the activities of daily living. Et cetera. And so for this subgroup, you know, people generally 85 and older who are dependent, to me this is really it's the most important prevention thing is whether or not this was assessed and whether or not they're getting appropriate help on a daily basis.
I was just going to add sort of the second piece that, you know, that the assessment might be important. I mean, are they even being assessed? But
right.
Then I think that that's the issue I had with the way that measure was originally worded, you know, that we got it. I thought, well, you know, how do you relate that to actual process of care or expectation in terms of care? But
yeah.
I think, you know, with Mike said, you know, I mean, if there are requirements to do it, and then if you capture the findings that differentiate those that need follow-up or not, it'd be important also to to make sure they got the follow-up care.
At the risk of saying in Minnesota again, our state nursing home regulations, which implement really vague federal nursing home regulations, but in Minnesota, the formulation of a daily oral care plan, the assessment of the resident's ability, and then a regimen, a written daily oral care plan, must be part of the resident's care plan. So in Minnesota, it's actually required that they carry it out.
But
whether they do or not, you know, that's
what I was going to ask. What's the experience with what getting that done?
It's not good. Although I think it's improved over our 25 years. 25 years ago, this law didn't exist. This came into effect after the OBRA 87, so in 92, 93 years went into effect. Prior to that, the nursing home surveyors didn't look at this at all, and there were zero violation tags related to oral health problems among surveyors. So surveyors didn't, nursing homes really didn't care. They care now because they have been getting tagged, and they get fined if they're, you know, if they don't comply. So it's not perfect by any stretch, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
Diane and then Dick.
I'd just like to expand the description in terms of limiting to assessment of caries risks to say maybe this is where we expand it to assessment of oral disease risks, because, again, it would be much more comprehensive. It would address the issues we talked about in reviewing systems. If you have someone whose behaviors are risky to subject them to a higher risk, they may not have a caries risk, but they have other disease risks, and to identify it as that and make it much more comprehensive. Risks that would impact their oral health: pregnancy, substance abuse, history of domestic violence, trauma, smoking, tobacco use.
Not sure what category goes in, but we won't worry about that. Get that on a list of something just to add as a concept, which is a general risk for oral disease, which might include some subsets for caries and periodontal disease, but with other risk factors that are not tied to a specific disease.
Can I ask a question related to that, since risk assessment keeps coming up? Is there a standardized risk assessment tool, questions, anything that we could refer people to?
No.
Okay. Part of the issue.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. There are risk assessment tools in use. People, various groups have developed them. Some are further along in their development. There isn't a standard.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, the point was made, though, that the ADA has included some examples of risk assessment tools in the CDT book, which I think is meaningful.
So, again, I think that falls in the category of some have been developed and some are being distributed, but there isn't the standard yet of this is the risk assessment tool for any disease, including caries, which is probably the most developed. Okay, so the other thing that's left in this grouping here is comes up on this page on oral health education received, and on the next page, two additional items that haven't been talked about, which is adding advising about tooth decay and diet counseling in the medical setting. Those are all education things, which I think we talked about earlier and felt that in general we don't have much evidence that does any good, so it wouldn't be a top priority. We wouldn't be recommending that as a top priority. Anything more we want to say about educational interventions?
Paul, just kind of talking about patient education, and especially coming from the medical providers, I believe there are some literature out there. I don't have the actual paper in my mind, but I've kind of read through an increased behavioral changes in kind of, you know, 4-year-old and 6-year-old kids when their pediatrician actually told them why is it important for them to kind of, you know, go to a dentist. So there was an increased number of kids going and seeking dental care. So obviously it would go back on the level of evidence in terms of, you know, what's out there, and that might be something that we might want to look at, or the people who are developing. So I would leave it up to the group in terms of, you know, looking at that.
Okay. Any other comments about this area?
Um, which is about the intraoral films taken. Terry, you made a comment about overuse or underuse, overutilization, underutilization. I think that's an area definitely to try to measure that, because I think there's certainly times that there's underutilization, significant underutilization, and I would suspect that there's times that there's significant overutilization. There are definitely guidelines out there. So I think it would be worthwhile trying to see how we can measure that.
So we had previously a list of services. There was a whole list of different kinds of services. So you're suggesting adding that to the list?
Yeah.
Right. Although I would just comment, I think that the guidelines out there are pretty vague.
I would agree. Right. And I think that's why there's potential over. But even if you make them vague and you have a gray area, I think there's still a lot of patients who they should have gotten x-rays, they didn't, and therefore there's caries and periodontal disease that is not being treated, and then there is some aggressive revenue enhancement.
We just did a study at our school where we took a set of cases, basically just slides of people, described their health condition, showed pictures of their mouth, and asked a group of our faculty and students, what x-rays would you take? And their agreement was worse than our agreement on these measures that we tried to do.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
I was just going to mention that we've looked at the use of radiography in dentistry for a long time, looking at millions of people. And although I believe in some cases there is an underutilization of radiographs, the overutilization of radiographs in dentistry is shocking. Mm-hmm. I don't know why people don't glow in the dark from dental radiographs, quite frankly. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that in many cases, either dentists graduated from dental school and were told to take radiographs every 6 months, come hell or high water, or they use it as a revenue enhancement vehicle. And whatever is occurring. My daughter's a radiologist, and I mean, she just can't believe the use of radiography in dentistry. I mean, she just thinks it's abuse and an overuse.
So, I think what I'm hearing is agreement. This is an important issue. The question is whether it's feasible in terms of can you actually come up with, if you measure, what are you measuring it against? Are there really criteria that could be developed? So.
Right. Like I said, it was a Pandora's box.
Yeah.
I close it again.
Right. I think that's the end of Area D, unless there's anybody else wants to add anything to Area D. We'll move right into Area E then, which really only has one new thing in it, which is, it's got a couple on the next page. On page 5, the only new thing there is the fluoridation of the water supply, either the water supply or use of fluoridated water. So I don't know if there's any comments about that as developing measures around that. Right now there are lots of people who are measuring that, and it's assessed in a lot of different ways, and you can get all kinds of charts, but there really aren't standardized measures, really not at the NQF endorsement level. So,
although the use of fluoridated water is an issue, so as a pediatrician, I can say, is your water fluoridated? But I can't necessarily, I don't necessarily get into the detail. Okay, where do you get, what, for this child, where do they drink most of their water? Are they spending their days at their grandmother's house that doesn't have fluoridated water? Is the water at school fluoridated? Where are they getting their intake of water? So I think that's a different question, other than your water fluoridated, which is what a lot of the information is.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, CDC tracks this, and I basically look at this as a public health sort of measure in terms of the extent of water fluoridation. Mm-hmm. I don't see it falling all that much into, performance measurement within the context that I understood when we were doing it. I thought it was just maybe a little bit of field.
The way I understand it, the question is not is your water fluoridated, are you drinking it? That there's a lot of kids and a lot of adults who are drinking bottled water and are not getting that at all.
Yeah, well, if that's the case,
so
then I go back to David's point, how are you going to measure that?
Right.
It would be the use of fluoridated water, not whether it's in the water.
Correct.
What's the use of it? But then you're raising the question, is that actually feasible to measure?
Right, it's much more difficult.
And then Mary.
I guess I do have one thing on my mind. I didn't really raise my hand, but I must have had a puzzled look on my face again. The one place that I think you might use it for kind of either performance measurement or sort of program management would be studies like the one that Texas did that tried to correlate Medicaid spending with whether or not the counties that the kids' residents were fluoridated or non-fluoridated. But, again, that's a little distal from where we are today.
I just was thinking as a quality measure for dental practice, you would want to know whether the provider has assessed whether the water's fluoridated or not, and that's what the child's drinking, not whether the town is fluoridated or...
Assessed whether the water's fluoridated or that the water that the child's drinking is fluoridated.
Right.
Is
so for me, it's like the same as advising about tooth decay. If you're going to do a chart review and find out whether somebody conducted a risk assessment, part of it is asking about fluoridated water. Not whether the water is fluoridated or not, but asking about whether the
And I suppose all sources of fluoride, I suppose.
Yep. Right. Correct.
Recognize I do have a bias in that I come from Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is the birthplace of water fluoridation. So one of the thoughts here, too, is that the very notion of measuring is to cause motivation. And we do see, the effects of community water fluoridation from an oral health standpoint is considered one of the greatest public health measures that we've done. And by measuring it, I see in this political time where we're seeing communities recede from community water fluoridation, I think us measuring this makes a statement that we feel that it is important to stay the course on this, especially if we're looking at having, our return on investment here. The return on investment for that compared to the adverse outcomes is great. At least the evidence makes us think it is. So I think we should continue to advocate for measurement.
Well, I'd just say, I'm from apple pie, too, but, from my standpoint, where it comes down, it's the original comment I made about, are we talking about the safety net context, the Medicaid context, the public health? Are we going to, is part of this project to identify what are really public health measures? Because I don't know how, other than CDC determining what communities have water fluoridation, I don't think they're going to quit that. So how does that fit within this measurement context? And I totally agree with everything that's been said about the positive effects of water fluoridation. I just didn't think it was a very good fit for what this task was, I understood.
What I'm hearing is that if you take it down to the level of
risk assessment
of the use of fluoridated water, then the use of fluoridated water could fit into what we're doing, so that it could be considered important, but I'm also hearing and thinking myself it's unfeasible because I don't know where the data would come from. I don't think we have data sources now that you could look at.
Dick?
Who could be against water fluoridation? Nobody.
Right.
Yep. Anybody that has a reasonable mind. But there's another side of this issue that doesn't have necessarily to do with public water fluoridation. It's naturally occurring fluoride, and there are parts of this country that have very high levels of naturally occurring fluoride. When I was a state dental director in Minnesota, we had some children referred to us that were in the Duluth area on private well water. And there just happened to be an old public health service dentist at the University of Minnesota. Nobody could figure out what was wrong with these kids. Their teeth were brown and black and so on and so forth. And so we did an epidemiologic investigation of that whole subdivision and found that the water, the naturally occurring fluoride in the water was about 4 parts per million. In addition, although the health department had been promulgating the need to test the water supply, these dentists were giving these children dietary fluoride supplements on top of it because it was well water. And I had a little bit of difficulty convincing the Minnesota Dental Association that they needed to test the drinking water. But after this happened, I never heard a word again. So You know, there's places like little towns in Minnesota that even the well water supplies are naturally fluoridated. Elm Grove is one of those places. So all I have to say is I think there's an importance to testing the water supply of wells. The importance is greater in some areas of the country than in others, but I personally didn't think it would be necessary in Minnesota, but definitely is.
Okay. Any other thoughts about this area? The only other thing that's left in this group, we've talked about abnormal mouth tissues, is the one about tobacco use, screening education. So we have talked about that before. We've talked about it in the context of soft tissue lesions, and we talked about it in the context of overall risk assessments, looking at various factors that could lead to various kinds of dental disease.
Paul, so there's a tremendous amount of evidence that says that the potential to quit smoking is 60% higher if a healthcare provider mentions that they think they should quit. So even if they aren't going to do, offer tobacco cessation therapy, just asking the question, do you smoke? And if they say yes, are you interested in quitting? How can I help you? Just, it would be good for your health. Just asking will improve. It should be a measure.
Okay. So you're advocating for that one as a listing it, all right? Okay, good.
I really think that's important. A few years ago, Bob Mecklenburg and I did a study with dentists, dental hygienists, and dental assistants in Minnesota to see who they were counseling about tobacco, what they were saying, what they were doing, and so forth. And we found out that hardly any dental professionals were doing anything in that regard. And as you know, smoking is one of the primary etiologic causes of periodontal disease. Once I was going to buy a house, and I went to the bank, and there was a woman sitting across me. She said, I see you're a dentist. You know. She said, well, I've had two periodontal surgeries, major periodontal surgeries, and you could see it. And I said to her, how many packs of cigarettes do you smoke a day? She said, oh, two or three. And I said, you're never going to be successful. Hasn't any periodontist or any dentist ever told you about the relationship between cigarette smoking and periodontal disease? She says, no, I didn't know this at all. So, I mean, that's the level of knowledge that's existing in the community because dentists are not providing the message that staying away from tobacco is just as important as staying away from refined carbohydrates.
I'd like to consider another aspect that maybe has not been listed here, and that's blood pressure monitoring in dentistry. I know many community health centers do routine blood pressure monitoring before administering any kind of local anesthetic or procedure on a patient. It's not necessarily wide scale at this point, but it's definitely being done. But we found in our own state efforts to educate dentists, even giving them free blood pressure cuffs and automatic systems, that they are reluctant to use them. In addition to the fact that they don't talk much about cessation of tobacco, even though we have a quit line program and all sorts of resources available to them. So I think in one sense, we're going to have to probably emphasize the importance of the connection between blood pressures and adverse safety outcomes from treatment that can actually be heightened if that person's blood pressure is out of control. I might even want to mention one other step that has not been considered and certainly not in practice today is that dentists should be a part of assessing diabetes or the potential of diabetes among patients who come into their practices. They're adults. And there are multiple reasons why, because of the fact that they have abnormal periodontal tissue response. They can exacerbate other conditions in the mouth. Having knowledge of that person's A1C or other level might be very effective in helping that dentist formulate a treatment regimen that is multidisciplinary that may be able to bring that patient to compliance. So I think there are pieces here that we're not looking at.
Just to kind of touch base on what Bob was mentioning, there are a lot of these criteria or measures within the meaningful use side of things, although they don't mention for dentistry, but if you look at the eligible providers, dentists are also one of those, but there are several other challenges which I'm not going to get into because of the Medicaid and, you know, the Medicare not taking dental patients. But if you look at some of the measures, there are, I believe, some NQF measures as well in that weight, high tobacco, you know, usage within that. And all these, there are also more granularity in terms of collecting this data in a structured way within the, you know, EHR. So that might be a good place for us to kind of take a look at.
And just to follow up on that, there's one commercial vendor, dental vendor, EHR vendor, who has, who is fully certified, and I know your EHR is fully certified. So there's at least two EHRs who have six meaningful use quality measures implemented. So I think we probably want to look at those because my gut feeling is they're the same. I know for sure that blood pressure is one of them. Pneumococcal vaccine for patients over 65 is another one. So we probably want to piggyback on those so that we're really in sync with those, which I think are really important measures.
Just to add to that, yes, Elizabeth, at Marshall Clinic, we have integrated medical dental record, and, you know, we went for the certification. In meaningful use, your system has to be certified, and the way we kind of handled it was, you know, in making dental module as a part of the medical EHR and then certifying it as a module. So a lot of these measures are kind of across, whether you're a dentist or a physician, you know, reporting the weight and, you know, tobacco usage and a bunch of other things that are there, we are covering it for the dentist as well. So that might be a good area to look at.
Just wondering about how to categorize this. So we have a couple of things we've just been talking about that would be under the general listing of risk for oral diseases. So tobacco is clearly one, although it has impacts beyond oral diseases, but it does have a risk for oral diseases. And you listed, I think, some others, so pregnancy and a whole list of other things that would be risk assessment for oral diseases. And I think the things we're now talking about in the last couple of minutes have been risk assessment or screening for general health conditions. In other words, to what extent are dentists doing risk assessment or screening for conditions like high blood pressure or measuring blood glucose? You come up with a whole list of potential things that people could measure, to what extent dentists are doing them. Some of them, there'd be no point in it because we know no dentists are doing them. But some things, I think, for instance, blood pressure monitoring has been promulgated for a long time. Dentists have been told in dental school that they should be doing that. It's a reasonable measure to see what people are doing.
Yeah, so I call that where the role as the dentist is the public health ambassador. And I think where it's really where the dentist and the medical doctor work together and really are in this collaboration and cooperative relationship, which, again, I think that's part of what we're trying to do here. So I think it's to say, well, the dentist is never going to do that. I think we need to say the dentist is going to do that, and this is one, you know, way, hopefully, that we can nudge towards that.
Also, I'm sorry, I was just thinking that the fact that dentists don't do it doesn't mean we shouldn't measure it. At the same time, how do we get them to start doing it if we don't have a benchmark in order to compare if there's an improvement? But the other issue is I disagree with the fact that this has no direct effect on oral health. I think the fact that diabetes has a direct effect on oral health. The fact is that blood pressure monitoring has a direct effect on quality outcomes in dentistry. In other words, doing procedures in a situation that's unsafe to that patient puts them at risk. So I tend to disagree that this is now overlapping.
I was just going to say, this is probably one of the few areas where you might actually be able to find some really good evidence, because wound healing is impaired by all of those diseases. I mean, the plastic surgeons won't operate on you if your BMI is greater than whatever. And so it would make sense that if you were offering an elective restorative dental procedure that you would have to do, notify those patients of their wound healing problems that might occur if they're still smoking or if their blood pressure is out of control. So, I mean, I totally agree with you, Bob. I think this is one of the areas that you will be supported by CMS. You will, because these are already measurements that they're measuring on the medical level. So
maybe if we just change the characterization, the bucket, it would be maybe risk. These are all things that would affect risk for oral disease or impact oral disease treatment. Yeah.
Just wanted to reiterate what Amy just mentioned. Hypertension, there are literature out there that kind of connects it to periodontal disease, and, you know, that we should definitely look at them.
Okay. So anything else in the last category we're talking about? I mean, the title of it's oral health interventions, but some of the things more or less fall into that general description. So the next one, which and Don, I don't know if you want to say a little bit about this, the one of number H, which is disparities. You know, we've been asked to think about disparities.
No, G, priority area G.
I skipped it because there's nothing. Everything there is a repeat from some other areas.
Well, we should just ask the question whether or not there's anything we haven't talked about that belongs here.
Okay, sure.
So,
Just one thing that I wanted to highlight there was kind of continuation from our topic about what are the things that we want to measure. One thing, dentists have not done this before,
sure.
And I don't know whether they would really do it or not, but we see a lot of kids walk into our dental clinics, and most of our physicians have access to a system called RACIN, which is immunization registry, where all of our medical centers, and now we are also trying to target the dental centers, where it's an added opportunity to kind of see whether the kids are immunized or not. Have they kind of are they meeting with some of the immunization or not? Maybe it's not even kids; they are kind of people who are making the first point of contact to any healthcare centers coming into a dental center, and maybe just trying to kind of ask that question as to are you immunized and what some way of figuring that out. I think that has to come from that interdisciplinary team, and I strongly feel dentists are part of it.
Okay, well, you can add that.
Okay. And then Andrew and then Mary Alice.
Okay. This is for Bob Russell's sake. I think it's extremely important for the public health infrastructure in the state to include some type of a dental health organization with a dental director who can serve as the coordinating focus, especially for disadvantaged adults and children, to work with the health commissioner and the legislature and the bureaucrats to really focus whatever resources are available on treating individuals in need. Now, in states that have that, there's much more success than there is in states that do not have a dental health program. So in terms of oral health infrastructure or public health infrastructure, I think that's a very definite need. Do you agree, Buck? Okay.
Did you have a comment? And then
mine was just really housekeeping. I know that F, priority area F, doesn't show up in the high-level thing, but I just wanted to make sure that we had talked about that's cleft lip and palate, and we had kind of talked about that earlier in the day and said we might get back to it, so I just wanted to make sure we didn't drop it if there was something, if there was anything else anybody had to say about it.
We'll get to that in a second. I'm not sure G, we fully finished with G, but, we will touch on the F piece.
Mary Alice?
I just had a question about provider network. Again, that presumes that people are covered by a particular plan or insurance company, or the way it's phrased, provider network. And I wonder if what we are talking about really is measuring licensed dentists in the state and then the subset of those that are taking new patients or have a patient appointment slots available or that kind of thing, and whether that ought to be fleshed out a bit.
So do you want to, because, the I guess it's line 85, sort of lumps stuff together, talking about the provider availability, contribution of the safety net, is there an adequacy of the network, the number of dentists, characteristics, training. A lot of subpoints could come under there. Do you want to call out any specific ones?
Do I want to call out?
Do you want, in other words, I'm asking the group, do we want to add it, other than listing it as a summary like that, do we want to identify some specific measures of the adequacy, provider availability, adequacy of the workforce? Do we want to list some specific measures for development, specific areas?
A couple of things came to my mind when I was looking at this. Safety net should be not just FQHCs, but also community clinics and school-based dental centers, dental clinics. So I think you can get much more specific. And then provider network, to me, implies an insurance plan or a managed care program or something like that that really doesn't get at the number of providers that are available to serve the population and whether they're willing to serve the population.
But, Paul, I think you're saying that the the stem up there, provider availability, includes things like number of dentists and location of dentists and
right.
ratio to the population.
So what I'm saying is we could say we're calling for measures of provider availability or adequacy of the workforce to address the needs. That would be sort of one way to say it. The other way to say it is we want that, but that means, and we can list some things under that. So I'm asking, do we want to list
somewhere
things
I think that, you know, needs, you know, in some draft we'll look and see what the level of detail sort of that gets to be, you know, whether it's numbers of individuals, whether they're accepting new patients. I mean, all of those kind of things could be laid out.
So what I listed here were some examples that were in the big thing. There were some measures of the contribution of the safety net or some measures of adequacy of the network. They use the word network. So I think maybe
my problem is with the word network.
Yeah, I just pulled that phrase in from the figure.
Dick and then Michael.
Well, miracle of miracles. In the states that I am licensed, there are surveys that go along with the renewal of your dental licensure that ask those very questions. Now, I don't think that all the states do it, but there are a lot of states that do survey dentists in terms of issues like access and so on and so forth. So I think that you could actually survey boards of dentistry to see how many do this and see if there are differences by region, by state, and so forth. Now, I really don't know how many states do this, but I know it. The data does exist.
Michael? Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize the availability of the dentists is really critical because it can be very misleading if you just look at the ratio of dentists to population. And also, if you don't consider subpopulations, for example, geriatric or special need patients, you may have for example, Medicaid providers that are seeing children, but they may not be accepting adults or persons with disabilities. So I don't know if there's a way to capture that it's really the availability of a real appointment that's an issue, not some sort of magic ratio of dentist to population or something like
that. Bob, did you have a comment, Bob? And then Jim, and then Diane. Oh, Diane, just on this point? Okay, go ahead, Diane.
I was going to ask the question. You actually addressed it also, Mike. It's not only a question of knowing how many dentists there are, but who they are serving in terms of the populations. If they're only serving within a network of an insurance group, you may have, and the biggest challenge we have is how many endodontists are available. There's lots of them, but they're all in networks. They're not available to uninsured individuals in our county, very, very few, even within the community clinics, because they're specialists. So that's a limited resource that I think needs to be addressed. And then how many, again, specialists, I don't even know how many periodontists we have versus endodontists versus pediatric dentists. So those subspecialties and what are the needs for them? And again, not within, as was mentioned, a network, but again, for people that are not connected to.
Well, I was going to say, the feds have tried, or at least started to try to get at this through InsureKids Now. And, you know, that's got its own set of issues. And so, but I think, you know, that, you know, building upon that and trying to refine that process might be one mechanism, at least for the pediatric population. And, you know, it's just a question of how broadly do you want to expand that. And to the point about the different kinds of providers, most of the time, in the reports I've seen, pediatric dentists aren't listed as a provider type. So I think, you know, in terms of in the Medicaid world, where that's the bulk of the current sort of covered population, that at least getting people to sort of break that out would be useful. And, you know, whether it makes a difference or not, the results will tell.
One framework we could start with, and I know this is still under remodeling, is the health profession shortage designation criteria that HRSA uses. It does get at a lot more detail as far as the populations that are and the ratios of providers available to the population. It also breaks down the actual FTE availability of that provider, depending on the number of assistants, allied professionals, so forth. And it looks at the populations from the perspective of the insurance level or insurability and those are not. And it really changes the entire ratio effect. Some counties can be population-based. Some can be Medicaid shortages or low income. It's a framework that certainly needs to be further fleshed out. I understand that. But it certainly is a lot better than a simple count of the number of dentists in a given state and the number of people in a given state.
Yeah, I was just kind of going along with what Bob says. I think we ought to just encourage people to take as broad and all-encompassing approach to looking at the number of dentists and accessibility to those dentists as possible, because clearly in places I work, the dentists may be accessible in the summer, but they're not accessible in the winter. And you may have to drive an hour to get to them in the summer. And so weather is a factor, distance is a factor. All those things need to be considered when looking at this. And when you talk about subspecialists, I mean, a lot of places I work, you're just hoping for somebody who can hold a drill and fill a tooth. So.
Just a couple things. Just because a dentist or a specialist is in an insurance network does not mean that they cannot provide specialty services to Medicaid, SCHIP, and so forth. They just want to do it. What Minnesota Delta Dental has done is develop a case management system so that if a person needs an endodontist and none of them want to indicate that they're in the Medicaid network, they can find an endodontist for that individual. So one way of getting around all this trouble is having a good case management system.
So I'm sort of trying to organize this into what I'm hearing is the whole issue about provider availability or adequacy of the workforce. There are three sort of concepts. One is what providers exist and where are they and how they're organized. That's sort of a numbers game, and are they in safety nets and networks. The second one is how accessible are they by various ways of looking at that, are only in the summer or geographically or other things. And the third one is who are they serving, which would have to do with special populations, and both in terms of medical conditions, disabilities, insurance coverage, non-insurance coverage. So who they are, how accessible they are, and who are they serving would be the three main concepts. All right, anything else in that area about the – and then I also heard a call for a separate measure, which was about the public health infrastructure, some measurement about the dental director and other kinds of public health infrastructures in the state. Okay, so now we're ready for the disparities discussion.
Well, actually, one more. So F, we did take out, and it was monitoring and surveillance systems because it was about increasing states who did X, Y, and Z. So we didn't think it was appropriate for the discussion. But one piece of that is the cleft lips and cleft palates content area. So maybe this is just a good time to just touch on that. If you think that's generally an important area to measure, if anyone has any comments about measurement of cleft lips and cleft palates.
I don't treat this disease, but I think the key thing is the multidisciplinary care, and I don't know how to make that into a measurement, but if you can measure that everybody has the multidisciplinary group, ENT, dental, and plastic surgery, if they have that, then probably you're going to be hitting all the measures because you've got the whole team involved.
And, I mean, Renee, somebody may know, but there used to be, I think, a Healthy People measure that looked at that, and if not, I'm pretty sure that Wendy Meridian and some other folks might have been conducting some study. So I think you could find somebody that could lay a little definition and specification to that. That is definitely one sort of quality, I think, or performance sort of criteria that would be measurable.
Yeah, definitely referral too, although more often than not, the pediatrician is going to see those kids right when they're in the newborn nursery and send them off to whatever team is available, but it's possible that they'll...
Probably so, but I remember back from Connecticut days, there were, despite a very sincere effort in a small state to identify every birth and to get somebody from a craniofacial team there to do it, there were still fair numbers of kids who just happened to get hooked up with some surgeon and they weren't getting the multidisciplinary piece at all.
So we did have a recommendation earlier on in the day about having some kind of category related to developmental anomalies, and maybe what we're saying here, we can bring that back together with this, which is for developmental anomalies, cleft lip being an example of that, call for measures based on both the assessment and also the treatment services available. That's pretty general, but that would be the kind of thing we'd ask for people to develop measures around. Okay.
Well, I think, you know, generally agree with that, but by the same token, I think the cleft one and the team approach to that is, I mean, very much sort of a systemized, you know, sort of process of care that is much more than, you know, congenitally missing teeth or, you know, things of that nature. Right. I think it's a little, it's definitely its own.
Yeah.
And I think there's probably pretty good documentation that says that the kids that get, you know, a whole team involved do better. And that's ultimately what you want to do is show that by doing this, it's better. So, you know, and what they have done is going to be very variable, so you don't want to measure the individual components of that. But as long as the team's together, they probably
do. Yeah, that's actually probably the one of the few places where there's actually really good evidence on interprofessional teams and the value of them. And that's the example that often comes up.
Okay. Now we're ready for
Okay, so a little bit of background here. So this is the priority area for eliminating oral health disparities and improving equity. Initially, we didn't find necessarily any specific measures for reducing disparities per se. So what we had done, and as you saw in the workbook, was we included all of the measures that were currently in use for special populations, such as geriatrics, HIV, in use in Medicaid or CHIPRA, and that's what we put in that category. But thinking about this a little further and talking with folks from HHS, that's not necessarily what they wanted to see. We want to talk about, are there any measures, thinking out of the box, are there any measures here that target specifically the elimination of health disparities and improving health equity? One way to look at this is something we've talked about throughout the day, which is stratification of the measures you've already talked about by specific factors like race, SES, gender. So we can talk a little bit more about that, you know, to make sure we've caught all the factors or risk stratifications. One other thing that came up was measures of acculturation, which so the research shows that maybe it's not one or two factors, but multiple factors that may be involved in, related to disparities for oral health care. So that's one other thought. And then the second piece is related to how we categorized all the measures for special populations. The question is, are there related to vulnerable populations, such as patients in nursing homes, those with developmental disabilities, HIV, wounded veterans, underinsured, underserved, and high risk, are there any specific measures we've talked about today that would be most appropriate for those vulnerable populations other than others? You know, so if we're trying to reduce disparities, are there things we should focus on for some of those special populations that may not be as important as others? So just a few pieces of information to throw out there. And
so maybe we could start with the question of, when you're trying to get at the issue of disparities, are there specific measures of disparities that are different than measuring all the things we've talked about and then just stratifying them by how do those measures come out in populations of different ages, different socioeconomic classes, different ethnicities? That's stratification of the existing measures, but is there something else that could be a more direct measure of disparities?
I don't know if this is an answer to the question that you just posed, Paul. But especially for vulnerable populations that are in caregiving systems, there are regulatory environments around group homes, around assisted living, around skilled nursing, et cetera. And there's wide variation from state to state in terms of the degree to which things like we talked about earlier, having oral health assessments at admission, having care planning around oral health issues, and having accountable systems for triaging and care coordinating dental events when dental problems arise. So I'm not exactly sure where this goes, but the regulatory environment around the places where vulnerable people receive their other health and social services, to put in place practices and policies that enable them to access the system. Because these are not people who get up and say, hey, you know, I feel like getting a checkup, and I've got the money and I've got the keys and I'm going to go get a checkup because I think it's important. You know, these are people that are living in settings where unless the caregivers and their and the guardians and so on in those settings have practical systems to get oral health care, whether it's daily help with daily care or whether it's professional care, they're not going to get it. So I'm not sure if there's a way to talk about
the
regulatory environment.
Well, maybe what you're suggesting is just that we call for measures within caregiving systems to measure whether there are accountable systems to recognize and address oral health issues.
Yeah. There you go.
Anything else anybody can think of?
This is a complicated area. As I think about it, what we're talking about is whether or not we have a system that's distributed in such a way that people across these determinants have access to care. And that brings up a huge boatload of well, so we say even the current new innovative programs of expanding dental workforce and educating other workforce or trying to get them into areas like rural niches and areas where they traditionally don't exist and where people don't necessarily travel to get care elsewhere. That's one thing. Then there's the economic piece. That is, how do we get care such that is less expensive to people who can pay less? So I think this really dovetails out of an entire new area where I can see right now the states are wrestling with it. There's no doubt we have a variety of state approaches to how this can be addressed, and Minnesota being one of the stars in this area. So I'm just... And if for no other reason, maybe it's just a matter of monitoring those new innovative systems that try to address these issues. I mean, we don't have a cookbook how to do it. We certainly don't have a method yet that's happening that's necessarily proven. But we have new measures and new things out there that are subject to be, shall we say, determined to be effective. So maybe that's a category under here we might want to include, if nothing else, a monitoring system to say, what are the new innovative programs? How effective are they over a longitudinal period?
Jim. Well, I mean, I sort of think about that in a general sense, that's what the rest of what we're trying to come up with is supposed to be used for. Because you have proponents of X, Y, and Z, and the question is, what's the evidence that it makes a difference? And so if you're talking about disparities, I mean, I guess it's sort of figuring out what's the unit of action or the unit of analysis. And then, is it enough to just say, you know, does state X have a plan to reduce oral health disparities, or does County X, or does Plan X, or does whatever, but again, to me, what we've been doing up to now is to try to figure out sort of if you had things that you could measure to figure out whether X, Y, or Z made a difference, that's sort of the role of measurement. The rest of it's complexity. Either chaos theory or complexity theory. I'm not sure which one, but I think we're about the measurement piece. And I was sort of thinking, you know, I mean, what is there? We have the sort of classical or typical things we've talked about that have been dissected out from a health status standpoint, from a utilization of service standpoint. And, you know, if we relate all those things back to the cost of services and all that, we have sort of that general framework. So my initial reaction was make sure we identify the sort of important stratification factors that strategy that you pointed out, and, you know, look at the special groups, including things like kids in foster care or whatever, to, you know, where you have a system that's supposedly in place. Going beyond that into the big Pandora's box, I don't know if that's within the realm of this project or not.
Well, so we're kind of generally talking about assessment of systems. So I think I saw some, you know, good nodding, which could have been people falling asleep, but nodding when we talked about yeah, right, about systems related to caregiving systems or caregiving facilities. There seemed to be agreement that would be something you could measure. Now, what you're asking is, can you actually measure it at a level above that, which is what Bob's suggesting, or are we really just talking about a roll-up of a lot of the other individual measures to see how the systems are working? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, because, Dick's talked about a case management approach, and Bob's got an infrastructure approach that they're using in Iowa and whatever, and I would hope that everything that we've talked about up to now would sort of help identify things that people could get their hands on in terms of data and actually look to see, you know, to what extent those were working and what extent it improved disparities over time. But the measurement of whether that happened or not would be taking the general set of measures we talked about and then identifying what you thought were the important groups where the disparities existed and looking to see if the intervention made any difference. I mean, that's the way I think about it.
Generally, I agree. I mean, I'm not framing this in any specific way, but I think I agree with Jim that we really just want to know of those innovations that are coming out, whether or not over time they are effective. And I think we should be monitoring that type of activity on an ongoing basis. Does it mean that we're a proponent of anything? It just simply means that we are very much interested in what works. And we know that this area here is a vacuum, and it has to be filled at some point, and then we can be on top of it.
I know one of the things that on this other quality panel I'm serving on for AHRQ with the CHIPRA measures, one of the things that has been suggested there is that when they're developing measures for that process, that any measures developed, that the data collection include getting enough data about the populations that are being measured so you could be able to make determinations about age and socioeconomic status and ethnicity so that you don't just measure carries and say, gee, we don't know what the ethnic makeup was of the group we just measured. You make sure you do that every time you do a measure so you can get at some of those answers.
Just a little word of caution. Disparities aren't always what they seem to be. Well, back before protease inhibitors were really being used, we did a study in Minnesota looking at the utilization of services among HIV-infected persons versus the Medicaid population and SCHIP and the commercially insured population. Now, we adjusted for everything, so I'm not going to go through that. But what we found out was that the HIV-infected persons who were income eligible for Ryan White Health Care Act money had utilization of services that was very similar to the commercially insured population. However, the Medicaid population utilization of services was much different and much lower. So just because somebody's HIV infected doesn't necessarily mean they're in some disparity group. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the concept of equity and just highlight that in oral health, and of course I'm the geriatric guy, so maybe what I'm about to say is expected, but the biggest inequity is the age discrimination in dental benefits and coverage, public and private. It's an enormous age discrimination, and it's been there for a long time for a lot of reasons, but... And it's so huge that, you know, it's measurable 100 ways already. But I don't know if that's something we want to talk about in terms of quality, the notion that we want equity across the lifespan and as well as across ethnicities and urban-rural and, you know, things like that. For me, it's kind of a big deal that's like the most glaring problem in our oral healthcare system right now. So I don't know where that goes, but I just wanted to say.
But it does sound like another example of using the, maybe it's not a different measure, but it's a matter of making sure you collect data about whatever measure it is, how it relates to people at different age groups and different care settings and et cetera.
Dick and then Elsa.
You know, that age situation is very interesting. Some of you may remember that Larry Meskin published a study about the use of dental services based upon age in the Journal of Gerodontics, which no longer exists. And what that study showed was that people with means and elderly came in for dental services like crazy. And it was the people without means, the elderly people, did not get the services they need. So it's not just a function of age. It's a function of the means to be able to afford dental care.
Elizabeth?
Well, with respect to equity, I think it is, you want to define that a little bit, because I think about England with when do you get a kidney transplant? Is it at 65 or 75? You know, what kind of care do you get when you're 95? You know, should you get an implant or not? I remember one of my students who came to me with this fantastic treatment plan, very well done, which, you know, got definitely points for that. 9 implants, patient was 94. Very good argument. The patient said, you know, I'm in very good health. I might live another 4 or 5 years, and I want to be able to chew and eat and look good. Yeah, you know. So I think we want to define that a little bit.
Dick?
That's really not funny, because there are some dental plans that would cover that completely. And it's part of the certificate, and they're required by law to cover it.
Christopher?
But truthfully, age is a determinant in that so many health plans that are so many dental plans that are out there are part of a dental or a benefit package that a retired employee loses when they go into Medicare eligibility. And then when they have their health care benefits switched over to that, they do lose their dental benefits. And we see that in a lot of the industrialized states. So I think that there is an age determinant that we need to pay attention to.
Dick?
You know, that's true. But the dental benefits industry has been trying to close that gap, and that many dental benefit corporations are actually selling individual plans to individuals without any underwriting. And that's really taking care of those people, as you mentioned. And the reason they're doing it, not because they're good guys, but because there is actually a profit to be made there. And I'm sure the underwriters looked at it every which way but loose. And so I think the solution to that is going to be greater and greater. Now, that's not based on altruism, but on the ability to make a profit on those plans.
So I think we're not trying to design a dental benefits program here, but we're looking for measures. And what I'm still hearing out of this conversation is that most of the things we're talking about is using the measures already talked about and making sure we're collecting data across various groupings, age, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, et cetera, so that we can make disparity calculations based on the data. The only thing that I've heard so far, which is a new measure sort of unrelated to that, is the one that Mike said about accountable care systems within caregiving institutions or systems. The one that Donna raised up earlier was a measure of a culture, measures of acculturation. I'm actually not sure what that means. Ask Donna what you mean by that. Oh. Sorry to interrupt you guys. I'm guessing that it has something to do with health literacy. Is that what that means? That to the extent that people have developed understanding of the importance of disease, is that what that was getting at?
The acculturation?
Yeah, what is that? What does that mean?
So the concept of quite a bit in the literature on acculturation factors. And some of those theories roll up the particular measures that you've already discussed, things like economics, level of education, where you were born or where the parent was born, language spoken in the home. But they're looked at as a measure in and of itself. So it is, in some cases, it's derived from other measures that you've already talked about today. But in other cases, some people have proposed that there are other aspects to acculturation that we in the research community who deal with, for example, in Haynes, have not yet been able to account for. So there's aspects to acculturation that don't account for all of the disparity. When you consider, sorry, I'm a little dry today. Excuse me. When you consider things like SES, as I said, education, et cetera. Does that help answer that?
No. Okay, and so reason not is I'm just so I think I'm following what you're saying. These are all factors that would, I think, again, fall under the general heading of people's understanding about the importance of disease or their care-seeking behavior or their personal caring behavior. I'm wondering, though, what is the measure that we would be trying to propose, and would it be different than the things we've already described as measures?
Well, I think the acculturation measure or a measure of acculturation takes into account those factors as they influence one another together as one factor. It's kind of like, you know, the sum is, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And then there's some piece there that is not accounted for that you can't relate to just by looking at SES. And whether that's an influence of someone's culture or belief system, we don't know. And it may be one of those areas that we just, one of those areas we just don't have the information of yet. But there are great thinkers who have really discussed and thought about this, that maybe what we're talking about is an acculturation measure, which includes all the things that we do know, plus something else. And maybe it's just a matter that that allows you a different way of talking about it, but perhaps, you know, we may find with those other, that last little sliver that we can't figure out what that is, that contributes to disparities that we haven't already measured.
So it'd be really a call to develop the measures of acculturation that would be different than anything else we've talked about. So
yeah.
Sounds like, yeah.
Jim and then Bob.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I mean, you know, listening to that, it's sort of that it's going to be up to the research community to sort of identify what that is and how it could be measured, and then sort of in a performance context, one way we could get at that are through things like the CAPS instruments or whatever that basically ask individuals whether they thought they were treated with respect and whether or not they were able to communicate and, you know, what, I mean, I'm just sort of, that's where I think those, you know, might be headed, but there's a lot of development, it sounds like, work to be done on many fronts.
Yeah, it didn't sound like you were saying that there are some existing tools out there already. You talk about people are beginning to theorize about this and begin to develop tools, so there aren't.
Well, I think there is information in the public literature, published literature that has discussed and used acculturation as means of explaining disparities in oral health.
But are there tools that could be put in
an
actual tool? So I'm going to go measure acculturation in this population. I'm going to go grab this tool that you're saying that does not exist.
I don't believe it is.
Yeah.
In listening to you on this particular topic, I thought of something for you to respond to, and that is when you talk about the vulnerable populations or the vulnerable groups, categories, many of which have been mentioned here, is there value in measuring or looking at the shrinkage or expansion of the either number of groups that then fall into what we consider vulnerable, or from a population perspective, or the number of people in those groups collectively? So what I was thinking of, you know, you can look at disparity at the person level. Say this person's low SES or from a particular race, ethnicity, or you can stratify that based upon the criteria or measures you've mentioned, versus if you're looking at it a population basis, then maybe there's a decrease in the number of groups, and maybe nursing home residents, as we improve, nursing home residents no longer are considered vulnerable because we fixed that problem. So is there a measure in looking at this from a population, the vulnerable populations as a group, in terms of who those component systems are or what those component systems are that make up the vulnerable population we're talking about, that there is a disparity, that we could maybe show improvement or hopefully improvement, that we're not getting worse, because now this other new group or new system now 10, 20 years from now become part of that vulnerable population because we're doing worse than we were today. So that was something in listening to that I just thought I would put out to the group.
Bob, you had a comment prior to that?
As I was listening, I started thinking about one of the things in the disease elimination project we're working with DentaQuest that kind of came up was the idea of literacy, dental health literacy, IQ, the ability for the patient to self-manage and self-determine outcomes as far as the intervention. So I think that's, I would say, the 50% of the conversation should include some measure of how to measure the individual entering into the system, their literacy, and then back to that term, acculturation, because sometimes what they know, their literacy is affected by their environment. In other words, the culture, the beliefs, the community and its identification. I mean, we have many different, like Indian Health Services, they master in this kind of thing because they work with populations that have very unique, specific belief systems where they have to adapt their interventions to fit within that culture's beliefs. Okay, and that's one of the things we've not thought about in America, because as America diversifies and more people are coming from many, many countries that are becoming Americans, the reality is we've got to tailor our intervention in order to meet the needs of these populations where they come from, not what we ultimately believe is the right way to behave when you become an American. So I think that is getting at the substance here, but the question is how do we measure it? I mean, we can measure it to a degree. We might be able to measure entrance literacy when it comes to, do you know about how to appropriately take care of your mouth? There are probably questions we can design, surveys, things of that nature that might be to get at some of those pieces. Certainly, if we ever get to a full use of electronic health records and a true health history that looks at behavioral as well as those things, we will be able to capture that kind of data. It's a futuristic thing, but that's what I'm thinking I'm hearing, and I think that's where we need to be moving toward at some point. Otherwise, everything we're talking about here is going to be pretty, we're not going to really get outcomes. We're really not if we don't get this piece.
So this could end up in a call for people to develop measures related to health literacy or belief systems. And then the question is the feasibility of that. Are there tools that could now be used, or is this a, you know, back to the basic research community is going to have to develop those things? And I don't know personally how much that's developed for people to use them in terms of population measures at this point, but it's something we could put out calls for people to develop those, and they may come forward with them or not.
Michael? Yeah, I just wanted to comment. This is circling back a little under those IOM 6, you know, goals for a health system. Patient-centered, you know, is a key one, and that's really gets at sort of the discrepancy between the patient's desires and beliefs and the healthcare provider's parameters and beliefs, and you get into the whole issue of sort of the word compliance, you know, use that word, you know, or the patient's compliance. I think that's kind of a disrespectful from a patient-centered point of view, you know, to think of it that way. I was at a conference on patient-centered care where it was mentioned, and I forget the year, but that there was more money spent. It was on the order of $30 or $40 billion on various alternative health modalities than there was on all of the hospital-based healthcare combined, and that tends to be actually the direction that more and more people are actually making their own decisions and deciding what they do with what is being recommended by their doc or their dentist as one data point, but not a determining data point. So that's a long way of saying, you know, I think this is an interesting area, and the question has to do with patient-centeredness and how do you resolve, the old way of looking at medicine is how do we force all our patients to take drug X, Y, and Z if the 30-year-old data that we're basing it on is, makes it look like that's scientifically valid when the patients don't necessarily want to do that. And so I don't know how we measure this, but I think it's an important part of the healthcare world today that there be some kind of a fit, and the degree to which the health provider community gets off track with what individual patients or groups of patients that have certain religious or other beliefs, when those get misaligned, I think you have a dysfunctional health system where people aren't getting what they want. So I don't know, but I think it's a great topic that you brought up, and I don't know if we frame it as patient-centered, what are some things that we could measure about the degree to which the oral health system is patient-centered? Maybe we can, I don't know what the answer is.
Well, so it sounds like we're talking about an area that there's some general recognition that it's important but may not be feasible based on the fact that none of us seem to say, yes, there are measures out there that can do that, so we just need to start using them or develop them further. We're maybe in a earlier developmental stage in this area than we are in some of the others. So I think we can put it on our list, but maybe if we're reporting back in terms of the ranking these things at some point, the feasibility of this one may not be as high as some of the others. High importance, but not so feasible.
Dan?
I'd just like to comment. Perhaps that could go back to the access to care where the patients survey satisfaction and include something that would address it, because I think that's a good point. As a provider, we're trained to, we have an agenda and we know the patient has an agenda, and hopefully at the end of a visit we've met both agendas. But that may be it in terms of how the survey is framed in terms of its presentation to the customer satisfaction. It's one thing to say, were they courteous? Were you comfortable? Did you have a, quote, good experience? Versus, were you given advice you were able to follow through with? I mean, it's one thing to tell a family to do oral hygiene for your kids twice a day, but if they're living in a car, what's the probability of them being able to comply? And yet, are they then considered noncompliant?
I was just going to say, I mean, I think the folks that have worked on CAPS would that's probably the closest thing we have to a vehicle for doing that. The extent to which it adequately addresses cultural competency is probably still fairly general, but I think it's an area that's probably going to receive some additional attention for development within that framework as well. So, I mean, I think that's as close as we have to sort of, current or short-term, near-term possibilities. It's only one point of, it's the recipient or the beneficiary or the whatever's point of view, but at least it's a measure.
Okay, so we could frame this as something that could be incorporated into patient survey data, satisfaction data. It's a slightly different, put in patient satisfaction is a slightly different concept than assessing belief systems directly or that, but it's still something that might be more feasible to do that, given the current state of the world. So, all right. Yeah, so then we're ready for that one?
Yeah, so priority area I is, so most of the stuff we've touched upon are the things that that are missing here that we need to speak about.
Let me give you a little bit more information about the priority area. It's linking people to services and support from other sectors, which contribute to good health and well-being. And health IT can be used to link providers to each other through the use of EHR systems. The main idea is to facilitate communication between patients, between types of providers, and services through each. So I think the goal is really trying to get at communication between providers about patients and then from patients back to their providers. So that's where we're looking for measures related to.
So there really isn't anything listed here that directly addresses what you said, and the question is, should there be?
Well, I think the one piece about communication between types of providers could be related to the service, you know, the referrals or the oral, the health care being provided by different types of providers if there's communication between them. But yeah, nothing direct.
Well, certainly the care coordination model is important, but I look at states like Kansas where they've got this spoke and hub concept where they actually get extenders out into the their rural, actually frontier regions that connect to hubs through telehealth-type connections, and they actually can provide services in those areas and facilitate getting those patients into those hubs where they can get definitive care. I think in this situation, it's a linkage, which is the key term. How do we link the various systems together to create a net that people can find an access point to get the care they need? And I think that's really what this is fundamentally talking about. You know, certainly our previous recommendations about care coordination, integrated care, working as a team, and extending is definitely part of this system solution. And how do we monitor that probably would be important.
So, again, this is one that's not quite so easy to see exactly how it would be done, but I think the concept you just said, Bob, makes sense to me at least, which is to call for measures about communications or linkages among providers, and examples of that being the use of care coordination, the use of telehealth systems, the use of other kinds of methods that would be that would allow different providers to be communicating. Shared electronic records, obviously.
Just another topic to add there is kind of use of patient portals. I mean, if you look at, again, meaningful use, there are certain measures that they kind of go in different stages. The number of people who are registered who are using patient portals, maybe that's one way of linking, you know, especially looking at dentistry, linking the patients to their dental providers. That's something we might want to look at as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to just emphasize the whole interoperable health records and ability to the degree to which dentists and pharmacists and physicians and plans are able to exchange information and avoid sort of duplication of, you know, entering the same stuff over and over again and things like that. Seems like that would be a system-wide quality improvement if, you know, to the degree to which, and I, again, I don't know how to measure it, but just emphasizing that.
Amy and then Dick.
I think that's one of the this administration's ultimate goals with medicine in 2014 or whatever is to try to get a better electronic medical record linkage because, I mean, it's not just a problem between dental and whatever. It's a big problem even from doctor to doctor. They're redoing tests, and the amount of waste is extreme. So I think, I don't know if this group needs to really identify it as a measure, because I think in the whole healthcare unit, we're going to see that happen in the next year or two.
Dick?
Amit, is Marshfield doing this already? Good. Yeah. And have you done any research on any of the data analysis of connecting medical to dental? Or?
So we are current from 2010, April, we went live with an integrated system. So there's a lot of research being planned and some being done. It is a challenge when you talk about bringing dental data in a medical record, but you know then you're talking about like a lot of different specialties talking about, okay, endocrinologists, they like it, but maybe there are other groups who are going to say, no, we already are dealing with a lot of, overload issue in terms of information. So there's some amount of work that we started off, but it's just the tip of the iceberg, I would say, and there's so much more that we need to be
So doing. There is some resistance among certain groups of physicians?
It's not, I wouldn't call it resistance. It's just that they're in the mindset of, okay, we already are having a tough time trying to sieve through the important information. Now you add some more from the dental side. We don't want that. But then there are certain groups who say, yes, you know, it's very unique for my patient, and I do need the, you know, some level of dental information being sent to us. So
it'll be interesting to see how that develops, Marsha.
This could be another example of something we talked about earlier, whereas if we were to have a measure of communication or linkages among providers, including care coordination, shared interoperable records, telehealth, we could all predict the results right now, which was nobody would do very well on those measures because there's very little of that going on. So the question for us is it still worth developing measures as a way of saying let's get the measures out there as a way of encouraging people to do this, and that was the conclusion we made in the last similar discussion. But I think we all know there's not much of this, any of these things going on right now.
I really thought from the title of this healthy Build Healthy Communities that this was more about integrating oral health education and public awareness into the community, you know, changing what's sold in the corner bodegas near the schools, making sure that there's an oral health education component in school, promoting oral health in the community, not just the linkage between patients and their providers and the other providers to whom they'd be referred. But I could be reading this totally wrong.
No, you could be reading it totally right. So that, yeah, I think that's a good suggestion for something to add, which would be to try and call for measures of integrating how well oral health is integrated into other community systems.
Yeah,
of course, it brings up the feasibility question. How do you do that? But still, I think the general topic is what you said makes sense.
Or in educational systems, you know, in a health curriculum, if oral health is part of it and things like that, it's...
I was just going to mention the whole topic of social marketing. You know, we've got all these messages about the American smile, you know, the white perfect teeth, and that's most of the general public thinks of it as elective cosmetic area. We don't have good social marketing around mouth disease and the impact of mouth disease on heart disease and other, you know, chronic illnesses and things like that. So maybe part of this is having good social marketing around essential oral health as opposed to elective oral health. I don't know. So maybe it's something about that we need to develop measures about the communications that the public is getting. Kind of relates to your, you know, soda pop in the public schools and, you know, variety of different initiatives that could be done.
Dick?
A number of years ago, the Minnesota Dental Association spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to attempt to increase the awareness of periodontal disease in the population. They did everything. TV ads, radio ads, things on the sides of buses, handouts, everything that you can imagine. And after the study was finished, they found out that the campaign they had going increased dental knowledge, but it had no effect on dental health-seeking behavior.
I just was thinking of one other example. A community that promotes breastfeeding has public spaces. It has laws protecting nursing and things like that, and where oral health problems in infants oftentimes are the problem arises in infants and their nutritional patterns and that. I mean, that could be another example of how a community supports oral health. And I was just thinking of this one as much more broadly in that way.
I have to agree with that because in community-based interventions, we do find a great deal of improvement. We study WIC populations, Head Start, and others where we've done very small money. I mean, we didn't put a lot of money in it, but we chose pilot communities, develop a care not more or less a care coordination, but kind of like a champion in that community that basically did outreach to their churches, their local public places. There was someone they knew within that community, and they organized around others and began to build a community-based awareness campaign. And it drove a lot of people, in our particular case, to care. And we saw some significant increases in Medicaid utilization in those communities. And that's one of the reasons that we were able to build our statewide model, now called iSmile, based upon those pilots. So I have to say that, you know, I can say from the top-down level it doesn't work well. But if you focus the resources into the community, among the culture, among the individuals that you target, and then let them promote the awareness, it has a much greater effect.
So I guess that would be some kind of call for measures about community awareness, either measures of process, what kind of activities are taking place, or measures of outcomes, to what degree are people in this community aware of oral health, how to prevent it, what resources are available, a lot of things you can measure about people's awareness around oral health.
having things that work is key. Obviously, marketing works, right, in general, but not all marketing works. So you've got to have the right strategy for the right thing you want to change. So, yeah, some measures around that, I think, would be really great.
Okay.
So we're a little bit ahead of time, and I wanted to just give people the option of taking a five-minute bio break or whatever you want to do, or we can just plow right through. Is there any preference?
I should at least stand up and stretch. Or
5 minutes? Let's take 5 minutes. So that's like a one bio break and then back or whatever you need to do.
So we really are into the home stretch here. Really down to the last area, which is item J. And on this, I just actually picked out a really just one concept here, which was the expenditures on various aspects of oral health care. There was a number of items that had to do with how much money is being spent on various things. And then the other one, there were just too many of them and too all over the place, so I didn't even try. But if we want to pull out the longer spreadsheet on number J, which is I think the bottom one in the pile that we all got, the big heavily clipped pile. I'm going to pull out the bottom one and really just scan through it to see if there's anything else that jumps out other than expenditures on various aspects of oral health care that seem like they're important that we should be talking about. Maybe that would be just take a minute to do that. And also that seem different than stuff we've already talked about. It says priority area J. It's the last bundle. It's not the last page, but it's the last. If you look at the last thing in the pile, unclip the clip and look at the bottom one, bottom thing in it.
Yeah.
It says priority area J. Maybe the second to the last one.
The last one was a list of priority areas. So it's the second to the last one. It says priority area J. These were all measures when we did our scan that we didn't think fit under any of the other buckets. You may argue that some of the ones we put in the other buckets didn't fit either, but these were sort of our leftover measures. So I think that the conversation is what Paul just mentioned. Is there anything in here worthwhile talking about as important and feasible we might suggest?
Many of these seem like sort of stratifications on the things we've talked about. For example, ECC patients seen last month with documented carrier's risk. So we've talked about measures of carriers. We've talked about measures of carrier's risk. So I'm not sure there's anything new in that. But David.
One thing that comes to mind is some work that's been done on determinants of health. And as caregivers, I think we're always surprised that health care per se is only worth about 20% of one's health outcomes. And this social determinants and healthy communities is significant. One thing that I was thinking of that might be considered here is placing in school systems, you know, encouraging better snacks and beverage choices than currently exists. You know, I'm struck by the fact that you go into a lot of schools, you see just Coke and, you know, high carb snacks and things like that versus water, other choices that would be encouraging better oral health.
So I'm going to turn, see if I can reframe that in terms of a measure. Maybe proposing some kind of measure of the something related to school-based food or drink choices, the extent that they're being available, being used, I guess multiple kinds of measures related to that concept.
Yeah, you're right. Yep.
Fit under the healthy communities?
That's where I was putting it, but okay. do you see not? Or Okay.
Yep.
And healthy communities.
There is another concept of complications that's been mentioned here under some of the Australian Council on Healthcare Standards. I don't believe we addressed a bucket that we're going to measure any of the complications after. There are a couple of routine extraction, surgical extraction here. I'm sure there could be other complications associated with dental procedure. So maybe creating a bucket for measuring some of the complications after a particular type of treatment.
Okay. Yeah, we did talk about complications after sedation, but there's a lot of other.
Yeah, and did we sort of capture the retreatment sort of piece, which a lot of those Australian ones are sort of directed at, need for additional treatment beyond sort of in linkage of procedures within some time period? I don't recall that we really sort of got into that piece of the realm.
No, we didn't. So let's put that down as a concept for development, which is complications and need for retreatment.
Does the complications piece go under patient safety bucket, is it separate?
Yeah, I have patient safety as something to come back to. So we've again identified it slightly when we were talking about anesthesia, but maybe it's a general. Maybe it's this whole issue of complications, which includes complications of sedation, includes need for retreatment. These are all things that didn't go well as well as you wanted them to. Some measures of that. So.
Yeah, which I think are going to, may reflect on whether the appropriate diagnosis and selection of treatment was made, or it may reflect on the sort of technical competence maybe around the carrying out the procedure. But that's a whole realm that sort of, I don't recall, we discussed it to a great degree. That's right. So part of it is that from a patient standpoint, and then part of it, is more sort of adherence to guidelines and sort of clinical competency.
Anybody see anything else? Mary Alice?
I had a comment about this expenditures on various
aspects of oral health care. I wondered what the purpose was of measuring this as a quality measure. Do we have a standard for how much should be spent per person, or should there be a distribution of expenditures for different types of services like orthodontia versus restorative care or preventive services, that kind of thing? And if so, how are we going to get at that with the difference between amounts paid and amounts allowed, amounts billed and amounts paid, capitated systems, FQHC reimbursement, which is lump sum.
You're not forgetting that we're in Washington, D.C., are you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first answer to that in and of itself, it's a way to get the value. So I think it's sort of used in conjunction with a lot of other measures. The allusion that we are in Washington, D.C., certainly there's, parallels in the Affordable Care Act as it stands, for looking at things like that. And I think there is interest in determining whether adequate resources are going into certain kinds of programs, and you could do comparisons with actuarial analysis, projections or estimates. So there's, but in and of itself, just knowing that X number of dollars were spent, I don't think necessarily tells you. It's using that in conjunction with other things.
So that came from, it's really the very last things in the last page of that other section, which says there's really two measures there. One is Medicaid from CMS, Medicaid expenditures on pediatric dental care, and the other is from Delta Dental Value of Services. But both of them, the actual measure, if you look under the description column, talks about the percentage of the dollar or the percentage of expenditure actually goes to care, I assume, other than administrative. Well, it doesn't say that, but it says it's really a measure of percentage of money being spent that goes to actual care. But that's just sort of one slice of expenditure. There's a lot of other things you could think about with expenditures.
I just wanted to pick up on that whole volume to value, efficiency, looking at that. So measures that look at value beyond the normal dental expenditures. So, for example, a lot of work on the value of regular dental care and cleanings for diabetics in terms of reducing non-dental costs, for example. So looking at value to the total health of the person outside of the dental budget. one of the problems we've had, you know, in Minnesota is you can come up with arguments why dental interventions based on the science are likely to drive down non-dental budgetary costs, and yet the way the accounting systems work, they don't care. So if we could have measures that cause more rational spending where we don't just look in one bucket, we look at all the buckets and say, well, hey, we might have to spend a little bit more money in this bucket, but if we do that, the diagnosis will be more accurate, the number of unnecessary procedures will be reduced, and people will save twice as much money on other health consequences because they were healthier, for example. So measures that look at the total value of oral health interventions, in the total in and inside and outside of the dental budget, I guess.
This is not related to this, but sort of following up on number 22, the metric that's there or the measure that's there on radiation oncology, referrals, that's probably not appropriate for this, but what is probably appropriate is that all patients being referred for radiation therapy to their oral cavity need a dental evaluation prior to starting radiation for caries management, fluoride, and management of disease beforehand.
Most dental plan corporations have actuaries that are beating their pencils to death or their computers to determine the distribution of services provided and the various costs associated with those services by group and subgroup. But the key to that is linking that information to the quality of the clinical decision-making process. And that can be done. And when that's done, it probably shows the effect that the dentist has on the oral health care that the person is getting. I mean, some of the treatment plans are just, they're wall-to-wall crowns and so on and so forth. Others are preventive and very conservative treatment plans. And by looking at that and looking at the populations that are being providing the care, you can really look and see which dentists are providing care that's most consistent with the epidemiology of the group or subgroup, and also most consistent with the most recent scientific evidence and scientifically based clinical knowledge. Now, as Bob has pointed out, it is also interesting, after you see the quality of the decision-making process in diagnosis and treatment, to see that to see if that care is completed. And look then, over time, at the oral health status of that individual using proxy variables.
So one thing in what you said is that there's some value in just collecting data on exactly how much money was spent on different kinds of things. So that might even just be your, you know, we spent so much money on a whole list of procedure codes. This is how the distribution was. Not that that is an end in itself, but you could use that data to look at in plans or areas or people or groups that spend more money on X, Y, and Z, how does it impact their overall outcomes? So there is some value in collecting just the data, the raw expenditure data itself. What else about expenditures then? Anything else that falls in that? Again, I'm sort of mindful of what David was referring to earlier about the whole issue of the triple aim. So the idea is just not to cut the cost of dental care, but it's to do that at the same time you're improving patient experiences and improving the healthcare outcomes. So in what other ways could we use measurement to drive that triple aim equation?
Paul, I mean, one thing, I don't know if this is on point or not, but certainly when it comes to some historical performance of some Medicaid program. I mean, that business, it depends on how you interpret that triple aim piece, right? Mm-hmm. Because I will contend for a number of Medicaid programs in fairly recent times, cost savings was not a very reasonable objective. Because if you got utilization that's abysmal, you know it's going to cost you more in the aggregate. But but if you apply that to the individual, down to the level of individual, is it costing you less over time, you know, with certain patterns of care? So I think, you know, tracking, you know, expenditures per individual and then measuring that against either direct measurements of health status or change in health status or some sort of proxy measure, if you can get it, that's where the dollar expenditure, you know, really comes in. And likewise, you know, if you look at a profile of services being provided in a Medicaid population, and 80% of your procedures and dollars are going into diagnosis and prevention, and nothing's coming through beyond that, when you know an epidemiologic, you know, condition of your population is much higher, again, that may allow you to either question whether or not the program is being effective overall, or whether one particular plan might be doing a better job of providing a more comprehensive care. And the expenditures are only sort of a start of answering the question.
Yeah. I don't think anybody would think that a state that cuts its adult program because of budget shortfalls is moving us towards the triple aim. They're just trying to save money, keep from going broke. David and Dick.
You know, our medical colleagues are very firmly entrenched in total cost of care, and that's an area that might belong here, is to be able to evaluate measures that could get at that in dentistry as well. Jim, you just mentioned it. It's, you know, there's the cost per widget, and then there's the utilization of the widget. And so often dental benefits plans and so on just focus on the cost of the widget. Just, you know, how much discount are you going to give me, dentist, for being in my network? Versus, well, I'm not going to give you any discount, but I'll be a better value for you because I use care guidelines to employ the utilization of the services that I offer. They don't tend to get that. And I think I can say that because I.
I think what Jim and I were talking about was a way to objectively get at economic value. You can actually measure the types of services provided in relationship to cost, total patient care costs over time, and determine which dentists or which group of dentists are providing care that is most consistent with individual or population-based needs, and get from that the return on investment and the quality of the clinical decision-making process that allows you to determine which dentists are the most cost-effective and efficient for the population being served.
Okay. Other thoughts? So we were focusing on economics a little bit, the last bit of discussion, and then anything else from the other category that jumps out. So, if not, we've reached the end of the list. So, Donna, where do we what do we do in terms of summarize?
The development of the measures of the patient safety.
Well, you had mentioned before that you think that patient safety maybe didn't
fit. All right, then I forgot. that patient safety was missing from some of the other buckets.
Right.
I just wanted to know if there was anything more you wanted to say about patient safety in terms of standardizing definitions or any types of measures to focus on specifically? I'm not asking to start developing, you know, the details, but any more guidance?
The only type of measure that I would really think of and that would need further development is doing the same that has been done in the outpatient medical world, as well as in the inpatient medical world, is thinking along the lines of a trigger tool, which is essentially a script that you run against an electronic health record. So this would only be for those offices that have an electronic health record. You run it against the electronic health record, and it gives you back records that have a significant chance that they have adverse events, and then you do a process and you look at those adverse events. And that is a real good measure to find harm.
So the potential is we could call for measures that would look at identifying and analyzing critical or adverse events.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm just mentioning it because I developed three of those trigger tools, and I know that they work.
Okay. We're going to have lots of applications to NQF for things. So.
Can I just ask, can you give me an example of one of your trigger tools?
Yep. One is failed implants, and you run that against a script that has and the diagnosis and the CDT, so the diagnosis of failed implant and the CDT of removal of an implant. One is IND, incision and drainage, together with a diagnosis of an abscess or an infection. And then you can, if potentially if you want to, you can link to the EHR with giving of antibiotics. So it's kind of a complex script that you write. And the third one, it's a very interesting script that you write for, we call it very simply multiple visits, but it's multiple visits in a short time frame with like dentists. So not a dentist and a specialist, but two general dentists or two prosthodontists. So it's like a handoff. And it was often an indication of unhappiness of the patient. And then when you dug into it, it's because something had happened. And then the fourth trigger tool that we haven't fully run yet, but we know will be working, is actually complaints, letters of complaints. We scan our letters of complaints in, and we know that on the medical side too, when you start scanning, when you start running scripts against letters of complaints, very often adverse events will come back.
Okay.
There was only one other thing I had written, which was
actually,
trauma.
I have two more. So
oh, okay. Trauma ahead. Was one that yeah. came up earlier. So if there's anything
anyone wants to add to the trauma discussion?
Trauma or injuries was, as a general category, and didn't really, I don't think we really got too much of that as we went through. So is there some specific things you want to say about that in terms of?
Would there be a fit there possibly with that healthy community section? I don't know. I'm thinking out loud, but I mean, trauma can be just slipping at home,
right.
You know, around the bathtub or something like that when you're a little kid. But it can also have to do with the livability of communities and the safety of that as well.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, no one's jumping up with specific ideas. I think we could just listed as one of the items to call for development of measures around recognizing, identifying, and trying to understand the causes of trauma, and then maybe even what was responses. The one other one I had, we didn't talk, I don't think really came up, was raised earlier, was the issue of neglect. Mike, I think you raised it. So I don't think we really addressed it as we went through. Anything that you think of reflect, or anybody thinks of reflecting back on that in terms of what kind of measures would you propose, or what kind of categorization of measures would you propose?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I know that, for both children and vulnerable adults, dentists are mandatory reporters of suspected neglect. And I know in the elder care environment, it's very challenging, because you have, especially in long-term care, where you have people who don't have appropriate dental coverage under Medicaid, for example, no care for periodontal disease, and they're suffering from periodontal disease at high rates, and you're recommending various things which then their family member or somebody third party to them would have to come up with funds to be able to do that. And you can have people with abscessed teeth. You can have, you know, candidiasis on dentures and inflammation and, you know, lesions, you know, et cetera, where you don't have coverage. And then you're dealing with a family member who may have limited resources. And so you're sort of, at what point is it neglect? It's very difficult. And I think that the gross inequity and disparities in funding put both the dental provider in an ethical dilemma and the family member or the decision maker for the person in an ethical dilemma. And it just raises a lot of issues about at what point do you say, you know, this vulnerable person is suffering unnecessarily day to day. And who ultimately is responsible? It's actually a very tough area. I know there was a paper written about it, and Paul and I were not happy with the paper because everybody's responsible. Medicaid's responsible, the dentist, everybody is responsible for that scenario. But it's real, and we have people. If you were to take that environment and put it on children in today's environment, boy, there would be huge outcry. Because children are mandatory to be covered, and there are procedures and standards in place for children that would say it's neglect to allow a child to suffer with painful infections, for example.
So maybe the issue is, I mean, you can go back to the fact that dental professionals are mandatory reporters, so you could get data about how often neglect or abuse is reported.
Right.
Whether you could get data about how often it should be reported, that seems almost impossible to me, but... maybe you could get at least data on how much it is reported, and maybe that would be useful in some kind of comparison, because you know it's a lot. Even though you can't measure it, you know it's a lot more than it's being reported. So maybe
right.
the reporting data might be useful in that context.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to just a second for the patient safety. I'm thinking, is there any way, or is it solely self-reporting that dentists indicate errors that they've made? I know we've had an instance where we had a situation where x-rays were reversed in our system and we didn't realize it until after we had retreated a tooth. I mean, we acknowledged it to the family. We told them what the error was. I mean, we took note of it in our own quality review, but that's something to me that, what if you pulled out the wrong tooth? And it was a permanent one. How is that reported? How is that tracked? And it makes me think again about that conspiracy of secrecy that used to be in a hospital operating room. I know I've been trying to propose, you know, stop, let's look at the record, make sure. And everybody knows it's the right patient, but do we have the right treatment plan up? Do we have the right x-rays up? And that's sort of like, oh, yeah, it's Diane, but, you know, slowly but surely we're doing it in the clinical. I'm saying this is an operating room, no different. But I'm wondering, is there a place to report that, or at least monitor it?
Well, self-reporting doesn't happen among dentists, I can tell you that. We have put in a timeout. I'm not very much liked, I can tell you. I'm working on checklists. I'm probably less liked after that. Running trigger tools against the EHR, not a hit. But at the other hand, at the quality improvement committee that we have, people are very enthusiastic. It's like anything else. Everybody loves measures. Nobody wants to be measured. And so it's just moving the ship very slowly that we need to go there. So I started actually with shifting the culture and doing a survey that, you know, we need to really go there. We are where medicine was 20 years ago. It's a very long route to go. I just presented at the IHI that dentistry is at measuring culture, changing culture, that we need to do this. We have a very long road ahead of us. This is why I'm just hammering on this patient safety, that if we don't get it in now, then we have another 10 years that we need to wait. And then Lucian is very, very unhappy with me. So we have to do this.
I think the answer to that question was that it is not very well reported. And to the extent that it is in more organized systems like a dental school or a larger practice, it tends to be reported in a way that is protected from disclosure because of the issues about malpractice. So it tends to be reported in secret vaults that are locked at night and all that kind of stuff.
I think you bring up a good point. I really do think we need to change culture, because there are a lot of things that happen that don't get reported, that nobody talks about. Drilling on the wrong tooth, taking out the wrong teeth, doing the wrong thing on the wrong tooth, and on the wrong, that stuff happens all the time. And I think that our medical colleagues have led the way. If we just start having timeouts, empower everybody in the room to say they think it's wrong, if something's wrong, just do some of those basic things that other people have been doing for years and make that part of our culture, I think it could make a big difference. So I think it's important to put something in.
We actually started with root cause analysis. We took, I come out of the hospital world, so literally took the root cause analysis form, and we had three major incidents. And once nobody got fired, no resident got put in the corner and shamed, I now have people knocking on my door, can I have that RCA form? And it's exciting that people now actually want to talk about it and put a group together. But it took a little bit to get there.
Okay. You bring up a really important point. I used to work for Ken Kaiser in the VA, who started this organization. And the one thing he did is develop amnesty for people who report mm-hmm. their mistakes. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of mistakes came out. Then politicians came in subsequent administrations, who said, we want accountability, and everything went subterranean, and nobody knew what the hell was going on again. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an excellent point.
And let me tell you, it's a very long road, even in an area that's been doing it for years and years. I mean, we still, in our huge, humongous institution, have doctors who don't want to time out. And it's crazy.
That gives us a job and a cause.
Yeah. And we're reported by the government. I mean, if we don't time out, it's a JACO hit. So, I mean, it's not just us trying to protect ourselves.
Okay. So it sounds like we could, again, call for measurement development in that area. How much the data is available is a question. So feasibility, I guess.
No, I think if there's an EHR, there's data. It's just if there's no EHR, that we just have to wait. And I think, as meaningful use is in place and people get very excited about the money for it. So if you just think about the FQHCs, the dental schools, all the clinics in the hospitals, there's lots of areas where we can start. We might not be able to start with the individual practitioner, but that doesn't mean that we cannot start somewhere.
Okay.
I just wanted to comment. I don't know how widespread it is. I know in Minnesota there are mandatory reporting forms for adverse events related to anesthesia, either IV sedation or other anesthesia. So there might be some readily available reporting on at least that from several states. I'm not aware of other categories like that. But
anything else that we've missed? I think we've picked up the other things we put aside during the day. We've come back and picked those up. We've been through the other list. Ready for the...
Yeah, before we wrap up and do next steps, I just want to see if there's anyone either on the phone or any of our guests here that wanted to comment or ask questions or anything of the group. Yep.
I don't want to take a lot of time, but I want to thank you for having a public thank you. I was saying it was great to be here today, and I want to thank people for that. But I was particularly sensitive to the discussion, maybe this is expected from someone in philanthropy, on the disparities in the healthy communities sections. And I was talking to Mary Alice about the fact that healthy communities really is not about services, which makes it difficult, I think, to put it in this measurement piece. However, I do think that there is some way in which the provider community, the dentist, have a sense of understanding the prevalence of dental disease in the communities in which they're serving. And I don't know how to get at that. So there's a way in which I as a patient, or the patient is able to understand where, someone mentioned why something is being recommended, but really, where do I fit? What's going on? And also the potential identification of some things in the community that might be apparent. The other piece is on the disparities, and several of the discussions have started to tick away a little bit from the clinical experience into the capabilities and perhaps the frequency in which a dental provider could be able to conduct a social history. And in terms of some experiences around trauma, issues of foster care, fear of dental experiences, and probably the one that might be most difficult, but was could be brought up in the context of either HPV, HIV/AIDS, is how to do a sexual history for patients. So I think that those are some of the things that are difficult to deal with, but ought to continue to be. We ought to challenge ourselves to figure out how to get at that, because in many cases it's the most vulnerable populations that we're trying to reach with improvement in quality, and some of these things are still not solved. So I just thought I'd add to the challenges. Sorry, I'm
just thanks, Ralph.
Any other comments or questions from our guests? Okay. I think Paul's done a really nice job throughout the day at summarizing each piece, so unless you feel compelled to summarize the whole day right now.
I don't feel compelled.
Then I think we're in a really good place.
Summarize it in one word or two words, quality measures.
There you go. So I just for next steps, we'll take all of the information we talked about today and summarize that into a report, and we'll likely send out an email to you for your review of either some specific sections, your recommendations, or the report in general. But the goal is for us to get that report out for public comment in May, so we're working on this report in April. In May, it'll be up on the NQF website for 30 days for comment, and then we will convene you by conference call likely in June to help us respond to any of the comments that came up from public comment so we can finalize the report and get it out in July. So those are our next steps. So, Ben, thank you so much for being here today and your feedback and your comments, and safe travels home.
I just want to also add that at the beginning of this process, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I thought this was going to be absolutely impossible. I couldn't imagine us actually producing anything useful, so it's been a pleasure to be with you all today, and I think we actually did some good work here. So give yourselves a hand.